Good afternoon and welcome to the School for Successful Ranching. I'm Grace Mentor and I will be moderating this session today. At this time, I would ask that you place all of your cell phones on silent and take all of your cowboy hats off. There's a table in the back of the room for you to place your hats. We would like to take this time to thank our generous sponsors of the School for Successful Ranching for their support of this program and commitment to producer education. They have small displays set up in the hallway back there, and we ask that you visit their booths in the expo and thank them. We couldn't do this program without them. Sponsors include Capital Farm Credit, Cattlemen's Education Series, Corvetta, the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Positive Feeds, Rabo Agrifinance, Stay Tough Fence Manufacturing, and Texas Beef Quality Assurance. Our presentation is titled Ask an Ag Lawyer. Our speakers are Tiffany Lashmet, and Jim Bradbury, James Decker, and Kyle Weldon. Please join me in welcoming our speakers.
Well, thank you guys so much for being here today. This session's a little bit different. If you were in the one this morning, and like most sessions, the speakers come up in the front and talk and you listen. This one is going to be you all asking questions, and that's how we are going to proceed. So what we're going to do is we're going to break things into kind of four sections, and we'll let you all ask all the questions you want on those topics for that 30-minute time span, and then we'll move to the next topic. All right, so that's what we'll do. We've got a couple of folks that are going to move mics around the room, so if you'll just wait till you have a microphone in front of your face to ask your question, that'd be awesome. One other thing I want to mention quickly, if you're interested in agricultural law, is a couple of upcoming programs that we have. The first is it's called Owning Your Piece of Texas. It's a free day-long event that'll be coming to several communities around your area. We've got some flyers up here in the front, and we talk about all of these topics in a lot more detail at those programs. This thing's just doing its own thing up here. The second program that we've got is our Ranchers Leasing Workshops. If you all are interested in agricultural leases, grazing leases, hunting leases, we do a half-day program on that, and again, we hold several of these around the state. We've got flyers about that up here in the front as well. So with that, here is our schedule, and the topics we're planning on covering are water law, energy law and leases, fence law, and then eminent domain and pipeline easement negotiation. So again, we're going to let you all kind of drive the train. We'll each give a short introduction of ourselves, and then we'll give a kind of a brief overview of the law in these areas, and then open it up for questions. So with that, we will do introductions. James, you want to go first?
My name is James Decker. I'm a lawyer in Stamford, Texas, about 3 hours west of here. I'll be discussing the energy law topics, oil and gas, wind, solar, and anything in that range that floats your boat. I'm a lawyer there in downtown Stamford. I do a lot of those areas of practice, estate planning, probate, real estate. I own a title insurance company, so a lot of times at these sessions, my questions fly off over into the title questions as well. So feel free, if you've got something that's really just bothering you, feel free to ask me about title as well, and I'll do my best to answer it. If I can't, I defer to Tiffany.
Okay. My name is Tiffany Lashmet. I am an assistant professor and extension specialist with Texas A&M. So I do educational programming and events related to agricultural law. I'm based up in Amarillo.
I'm Jim Bradbury, and I practice here in Fort Worth and in Austin, Texas, and I do water work, land work, land, farm and ranch land conservation work, eminent domain, a little oil and gas, as well as other things, and I do a little legislative work. I'm going to talk about eminent domain, and that's what I've been working on here in the last several weeks, so I'll give you a peek at that, but it's a privilege to be here with my friends up here.
Well, howdy and good afternoon. My name is Kyle Weldon. I am the youngest lawyer up here, but I practice here in Fort Worth. I was an animal science major in undergrad, so I have a passion for agriculture and excited to be here.
Kyle didn't tell you, but he is a special member up here because he got to do this as a law student. He was so smart 2 years ago or last year? Last year, he was a law student, did it, and he was so smart that we brought him back as a full-fledged lawyer now. So He can actually charge people for his advice now.
That's exactly right. Jim always says we're going to all end up working for Kyle. We think he's right. So if you're going to visit with us after, that might be the lawyer you want to talk to. So with that, we'll start with water law. And like I said, we're going to just do sort of a brief overview of each topic and then open it up for questions. So in water law for Texas, the first step you've got to figure out is what type of water you're dealing with, because we have different legal schemes for different types of water. Okay, so if you're dealing with groundwater, right, which is that water percolating beneath the surface in an aquifer, so like the Edwards Aquifer or the Ogallala Aquifer, with regard to groundwater, the legal scheme that governs is called the rule of capture. And that basically means that a landowner owns the water beneath his or her property. That's the surface owner, okay, unless that groundwater right has been severed off. Now, James can talk a little bit more about that from the title perspective, but just like you could sever oil and gas or minerals off and have a mineral estate and a surface estate, sometimes we see severances of groundwater that can come into play. But absent something like that, the surface owner owns the groundwater, has a property right in that groundwater, and has the right to pump the water from beneath their property. Now, there are a couple of things you need to know here. The biggest one is that is governed at the local level in most areas by groundwater conservation districts. And the legislature sort of decided that instead of having a statewide body that made groundwater rules, we'd be better off with local control. And so there are about 100 groundwater conservation districts in Texas. Not every area has one, but for those areas that do, they make all of the rules related to groundwater. So rules like, if you are going to drill a well, you have to get a permit from the district generally. They may have pumping limitations as far as how much you can pump. They may have spacing limitations, like how far from the property line your well has to be. Here's where it gets tricky. Every groundwater district, all 100 of them, has their own set of rules. And so you can imagine that all those being different can cause a little bit of confusion if you wanted to try to learn them all. So what I always recommend for folks interested in groundwater is to determine, A, are you in a groundwater conservation district? You can do that if you just Google Texas groundwater conservation districts. There's a map that'll come up. All the areas in a district are in colors, one of 100 colors. Areas that are white on the map have no district. Okay, and so you need to see, are you in a groundwater conservation district? And then if you are, you need to take some time to study up the rules of that district and see what their rules are as far as drilling wells and the pumping water, those sort of things. Okay, so that's a quick look at groundwater. Surface water has a completely different legal scheme. And surface water, for our purposes, here is going to be water in a defined water course. So if we're talking about water, in a creek or a river or things like that, surface water, and that is owned by the state of Texas. The state holds it in trust for the people, and that's governed by the law of prior appropriation, and that's administered by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, the TCEQ. And so a prior appropriation, the way the scheme works, if you want to use water out of a defined water course generally, you've got to go get a permit from the TCEQ to use that water. And so you've got to go get your permits, and the permitting process, they keep a database of all the permits by date. And prior appropriation means it's first come, first served, essentially. So an older or a senior water right permit holder has priority over a junior user. So when it's raining and there's plenty of water, we don't worry about these rules. Where they come up is when we have a drought situation. And so let's say you had one landowner that had a permit to irrigate from 2000 and another landowner that had a permit to irrigate from 1980. The landowner with the 1980 permit gets all of his water before the 2000 permit gets any of theirs. And so that's a little bit how that system works there at the TCEQ. So that's kind of the basic overview that I'll give. We're happy to start taking questions now. If you'll just raise your hands, we'll get a runner to you, and we will get started.
And now's the time I'm going to make before we take your question. If you're shy and you're not going to ask any questions, you need to leave. Because we're all here for you, so don't be shy about asking a question. I mean, water is probably the number one issue we all get questions about. So if it's a question to you, it's a question to somebody else. So, yes, sir.
Perfect.
So if you have a creek, and maybe it's a wet weather creek, what are the restrictions on putting a dam on it? Let's say that you have a small creek. Let's just say it runs close to the dam. Can you put, say, a 2 or 3 foot rock dam that may be 8 feet across on it?
So the question there is going to be if your creek is a navigable stream. Now that sounds like a dumb word because you're thinking, well, I just told you it's just a wet weather creek, but the legal definition is a little more complicated. Okay? So the answer is if it's a navigable stream, you're not allowed to put any sort of impediment to travel down the navigable stream. So you can't dam a navigable stream. If it's non-navigable, then you've got the ability to do that. Okay? So the navigability question, there's a sort of two-prong test. If it meets either of these, it's navigable. The first question says, is it usable in trade or commerce? So courts have said things like, if a boat can go down it, it's navigable. If you can float logs down it, it's navigable. Okay? The second potential test, and like I say, it only has to meet one to be navigable. The second test says, does the stream bed maintain a width of average width of 30 feet? If it's 30 feet wide or more, whether there's water in it or not, if the stream bed is 30 feet wide on average or more, it's navigable. All right, so that's how that question would be answered. The other place that the navigability question comes in is the public has the right to access a navigable stream even across private property. Okay, so if you've got a navigable stream on your private property, and I always talk about the hippie from Austin, no offense, Jim, in the canoe, right? The hippie from Austin can canoe down your stream across your private property. Now, they can't get out on the stream bed, they can't get out of the stream, and they can't cross your private property to get to the stream. But as far as coming down, they can, and that's where that you don't have the ability to impede the travel on a navigable stream. I think that's a good question, and I think the answer probably however the court would look at it.
Let me comment on that just a little bit, because this what you're getting at, what Tiffany just described, is a super hot topic right now in Texas. There's a Representative Andy Murr's got a bill in the session right now on this determining, because the GLO and the TCEQ are the ones that determine this navigability, and right now we don't have a consistent process for that, and some of them, if they call what we call paint a blue line on a GIS map that and declare it navigable, it's hard to erase that. But the answer to your question is really from the vegetation line to the vegetation line. But it's not just like measured on my property, okay? The determination of navigability is sort of the through stream. So while it might be 12 foot wide on your property, if it goes to 45, you know, two or three properties down, the stream may still be navigable. And I realize this is not sort of precise for everybody, but I don't make the laws. I'm just here to report on them. But to boil all of this down, I mean, to your impoundment question, if you've got a stream that's, a wet weather, 2 foot across, you could jump across it on a good day, you can impound that for domestic and livestock purposes for up to 200 acre feet by volume, okay? That's by volume. You can impound that, meaning you can build a little dam there. But I'll tell you, if it's wider than you can jump across, you need to be thinking about whether this is navigable or not, because then you don't have the right to impound that without a permit. You could get a permit, but then you have to tell all the downstream neighbors I'm doing that and go through a notice process. But everybody's little bitty creeks like that are really narrow, as long as it's for domestic and livestock purposes, you can build that little dam.
Hi. I have a question about we have a TCEQ permit. So how do you know who else has a permit on that creek? How do you know who else might have access to it?
Water rights permit?
Yeah,
the water rights.
Hang on while I figure out how to turn this on. Water rights permit, is that what you're talking about? Yeah. If you will go to the TCEQ website. I'll show you offline. But TCEQ is where we maintain the master registry of all surface water rights in the state. And there's a spreadsheet, if you'll click through there, to water rights, and it's updated. And it's just a giant Excel document, and you can search it by basin. And all of our water rights are based on year of priority. So it'll tell you exactly where the diversion point is, who the owner is, and the volume that's associated with that permit. They'll say, Joe Blow's got, 200 acre feet in the Brazos at this location. So you can then know what other water rights are in the vicinity of you, and good smart people now who need water, you can actually use that database to lease water or buy water rights from other people. It's slightly clunky, because it's TCEQ, but that whole database is right there online, and it's about two layers in from the front website.
I have a question. In the area that I'm in down below San Antonio ways, a lot of the trees, because of the drought, have died, so people have gone in and had them dozed, which has leveled out the creek bank, so it's like it's just a big dip now, and the grass is growing when we get rain. The grass grows down except for maybe this wide. And the only time there's water running is when we have, after a dry spell, it takes about 5 or 6 inches. But if it's rained, it maybe takes a couple of inches. Would that, how would they determine there what that is? Whether that's,
I don't know anything about trees.
There's no water in it unless they want to swim in sand. But
they keep looking at me, so I'll keep answering. If you're talking about this is a through stream, I understand it's kind of flattened out. The trees used to be here, so it's collecting more flow there. But, I mean, the through stream, even though the banks may be a little more sloped now, the through stream is what's measured. It's not just, as I told this gentleman here, it's not just how wide is it on your property.
But because it's been leveled out, it spreads it out. It's like running down a road now.
Right. And, I mean, if it's that way far enough, it well could be navigable, because a lot of these streams, they're not on the map. There's no determination. And what a lot of landowners are finding out, if you get curious and you call the General Land Office or TCEQ, they'll come out there and they may say, hey, that looks navigable to me. And then they paint it, right? And then it's navigable and it's on the map. And they're like, wait, I would rather not be navigable. But I mean, it's too late. So you can hire an engineer or a consultant to come out there and assess that without calling the state of Texas to determine it, because there is some risk when you call the state. If they look at it and say, whoop, it's navigable, it's kind of a done deal.
Well, the purpose is to keep from having to replace water gaps every time we get a good rain.
It's hard to judge when you get beyond that, 10, 12 feet, because you don't exactly know. And as Tiffany said, where we get a lot of questions on this is public access. Because once it's navigable, you have questions about whether you can build the dam. But the real question is, can folks traverse that up and down? As we have more and more people in the cities wandering out in the country, they can, if it's navigable, the public can travel anywhere they want, by boat or by foot.
Even if it's fenced?
Well, I mean, you shouldn't be fencing a navigable waterway. That's not legal.
Well, I mean, otherwise the cows are going to get out.
I understand. And, I mean, it's a complicated situation, okay, particularly for ranches.
Yeah.
Because when you have a navigable stream, you can't fence it off to the public, but you've got to keep your stock in. So you have those gaps that are designed that have a little bit of a flow through there. But I get a lot of questions because it doesn't have to have water in the stream for somebody to come travel down that stream bed. They can walk up it into your private property, and things can get rather tense there on discussions of whether the stream is navigable or private property. It's happening quite a bit.
Hey, Jim, that blue line map that you mentioned that the GLO has, is that something people can see, or is it like some dark backroom map?
It's kind of a dark backroom map. I mean, TCEQ has their own map. GLO has their own map. They're not necessarily working on the same map. It's a public document. So, I mean, if you want to know and you're curious, you can call down to either one of them, and they have helpful people that will pull it up.
Well, I mean, it's on the quad map, so you can see it, but it's a straight line, and it stops. It's a straight line, and it stops, which indicates it's an intermittent.
That sounds to me like it's an intermittent stream and not going to be a navigable stream. Don't write that down. I mean, that's not legal advice there, but...
Well, one other point to make there, right, is not every navigable stream can be marked on the blue line map, right? Understand that, because like Jim said, right, maybe they've never been out to look at your stream and they just didn't know to mark it. So don't think just because I'm not on the map, I'm safe, but that could still be an issue.
Okay, I don't mean to interrupt you, but before we do this question right here, when you're asking questions and when you're talking, try to talk on a mic. A couple people have pulled me aside and said, hey, I can't hear what people are saying, but if you could talk in the mic, that would be awesome.
Assume you have a large field, maybe 200-300 acres, and you build a stock tank at one end of it because all the water... The slope of the field goes to a point, and the entire watershed for that stock tank is in this pasture. Who owns that water, the surface water that's in that tank?
Got it.
You're going to put the new guy on the spot here. So the definition of, I guess, what a navigable stream of water is once it starts a, I guess think of it like a stream of water, like into a V, if you want to think of it that way. So water that's just running across your property on your pasture that's not actually into a stream is going to be the surface owner is going to own that. So you can capture that into that stock tank and own it. But once it starts getting the characteristics of a stream or a creek type situation, that's going to be that's no longer going to be your water. So for your example there, you know, you own the pasture, you know, you have a stock tank on one end, the water when it rains is going to run across and go into that stock tank. That's going to be you, the landowner's water, and you can own that.
Okay, second question. What do water rights, let's say on the Brazos River, typically sell for?
Does anybody... You stumped us.
Yeah, well, it depends where you are and, you know, what the demand is. I mean, the Brazos is an enormous river, you know. So if you're near a power plant, say Granbury, somewhere like that, you're going to be able to command a really good price. So, I mean, there's just not any really database at all out there. I have a lot of people call and ask me that question. If I've got 250-acre feet, what can I get for that? It depends, one, where it is, but you've got to get it from wherever you divert it to wherever they need it, okay? And so, I mean, one, you could build a pipeline, but that's pretty expensive. But to change a diversion point, because every water right is marked for a specific location for the diversion point, and if it's, let's say you own it here and it's 12 miles to a power plant, they're going to have to change that diversion point. I'm working on one right now, and we're just beyond 2 years to simply move a diversion point from one place to another.
There's 100 acres across the river from me that turned into a development, and everybody got an acre of water. But none of them have access to the river except those with the river from the river. And my place is right across the river. So diversion point.
Who's moving the diversion point, them or you?
Well, I would take it from the south side of the river. If I bought their water rights.
If you bought their water rights.
Right, I would take it from the south side of the river for irrigation.
Right. But if you buy their water rights, that's locked to a diversion point, okay, those water rights. So if you buy them and you already have your own, do you have a diversion point now?
Yes.
Okay. You will have to file the paperwork to change the diversion point for those water rights that are across the river to your side of the river.
Okay.
You're going to have to tell the TCEQ, I bought those, they're mine, you transfer ownership, then you're going to have to transfer the diversion point. It's just going to take some time to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
If it's all right, can we go back to navigable again? If, hypothetically, your headwaters of a creek goes through your property out to the public property, maybe through a state park or something like that, but it runs through several pastures on our land. We have it fenced with water gaps. Did I misunderstand about the, I mean, are we, is that's okay or no? We have to have water gaps on the creek because it's running through pastures.
It's, I mean, it's fine. I'm not, there's not a rule that says you can't fence a creek, okay? We all have to fence creeks. What I'm talking about, think of a very wide, maybe not the Brazos, but something that is 34 feet across, okay?
But it does, part of it is going to be that way further down off of our property.
And that may be. I mean, it may be navigable down there, but it's not navigable up where you're at.
I misunderstood because I thought if it was navigable some in one part of it, the whole thing was considered navigable.
It depends, okay? It depends. I'm a lawyer. I just want to tell you this is how complicated it is. But if you're up there in the headwaters where you get a rain, you know, and it's a very gentle collection and it's running really narrow like that, just because it's, you know, 44 feet, you know, half a state away, doesn't mean that you're navigable right there, okay?
Thank you.
Yes.
The other thing real quick on water gaps, just to be clear, Jim, you can kick me if you want to, but we're not telling you to go home and tear out all your water gaps, okay? We're just telling you that this is how the law works on navigable streams. You may want to do some analysis. It may be worth talking, like you said, to a consultant or someone. We're not telling you to panic and go tear out water gaps, just so we're clear.
Well, let me give you some easy advice. Protect your stock from getting away, okay? Right. That's the number one rule. Protect your stock from getting away. Does a hippie from Austin, my favorite analogy, does a hippie from Austin, if you have a fence across a navigable stream that is airtight for your cows, have the ability to make a fuss about it? That's the point. Okay, so protect your stock, protect your cows, wait for somebody to complain. Nobody's going to throw you in jail for that. But somebody could, because some people have, come and said, I want to kayak through there. And there's a fence across it. But for now, until somebody tells you otherwise, you can fence them.
I have a fencing question for the panel, please. I have a fairly new seven-wire fence in a pasture, and the ranch next door to me is for sale. It's probably going to be high fence. Can I stop them from tearing down that seven-wire fence?
Hang with us until we get to the fence law section. Do you mind? Are you going to be here?
Yes, ma'am. I came in a little late. I didn't know it was in sections.
You're good.
I apologize.
You're good. No, you're good. You're good. Great question, and we will answer it in about 30 minutes. Okay. My slide's not up. That's why.
I'm going to ask a question of the panel here, because I had a client who might also be a family member ask me this water question, and they didn't like the answer that I gave, so the response was, and I quote, well, I'm going to ask Bradbury and Tiffany. So that person is not here, so I'm going to ask them for y'all. The exemption for domestic and livestock use on impounding on a tank, pond, whatever you want to call it, how broad is the definition of livestock use? Is it purely for watering cattle? Can you do anything besides watering it? If you've got some Bermuda grass that you wanted to put out there, you wanted to water because the cattle are going to graze it, is that okay? What is the connection between the cattle and the water?
Which side of this fight are you on?
I'm guessing the same side that you are.
All right, well, let's find out. Okay, this is a good opportunity to talk about what I think is the number one water issue that producers need to know, which is the pond or tank that is in your pasture, depending on what side of the state you're from. There's a 200-acre-foot exemption, right? You can impound that much volume of water without a permit. Everybody else in the state has to get a permit to impound water for irrigation or any other purpose. It's a special exemption that's there for ag and primarily for producers. It's very, very valuable. What you're talking about, what's the scope of that exemption? Because it is domestic and livestock. The livestock, my interpretation of that, it's for watering them. If you put a pump on the side of that pond or tank and start pulling that water, even if you're growing corn for your cows, you're beyond that exemption, okay? It is, that's irrigation. and there's no sort of like irrigation for livestock exception. I mean, it's just for the cows to drink. Okay, so if once, because you're exempt, but once you put a pump on the side of there and you start diverting water out of there, you need a permit to do it because you're no longer exempt. I hope I answered the way you wanted me to.
Since you just gave me the same answer that I gave
them. Well, that's good.
The other, one other point I'll make here, and then we've got to move from water to energy leases. And if you have more water questions, we'll get them at the end. Okay, we're going to have 30 minutes of just open questions. But one other point to make with regard to permits you have to get for groundwater pumping, right? We talked about how you have to get a, you have to get a permit from the groundwater conservation district if you're in a conservation district area. There's an exemption there as well for domestic and livestock wells. So if you're going to drill a well and pump water for your cows, your conservation district will have an exemption from the permitting process there. Look at the details of your specific district, but that's an exemption as well.
I'm sorry, but just one last question, and that is, what are the penalties if you violate these rules? Who is the groundwater police?
So the groundwater police.
Are you confessing to something, or are you just asking in the hypothetical?
Really more the surface water police.
There are a number of third parties here, so the attorney-client privilege does not apply.
That's right. So your question is about the surface water police, and that's going to be the TCEQ. The TCEQ is the one who deals with any matter surface water related. So like to Jim's point, if the hippie from Austin comes out and is complaining about your water gaps, they would go to the TCEQ. The TCEQ can then come out, investigate. They have the ability to impose fines, those sort of things. Okay, we got a mic in a hand. We're going to ask this one and then go on. Okay, you're up next.
Thank you. One question related to the dams. We have a creek running through the property. I'm pretty sure it's navigable. It's got one dam on it already, which was built in the 80s, which is functional, but another one, which was built in the 30s, which is not, washed out. To repair that dam, is there anything which would be grandfathering because the structure is so old that you could get a permit or... you could repair that dam if it's in place?
I mean, if not really, because let me say this. It's a function of time. We have a lot of dams out there that are on navigable streams just because of the time and place they were built, you know. The rules were there, but people just did what they did, and we had more water and fewer people cared. So the fact that there is a dam that was built in the 80s or even the 30s on a navigable stream, it's still a dam that's out of compliance. There's no grandfathering element to it. That said, TCEQ has had to deal with this situation extensively. There was a major problem out in Kimball County about, you know, during the drought where downstream folks were not getting flow at all, and they went back upstream and like, well, now we know why, right? You know, some people have some very huge impoundments up there. But you would have to get, if you're going to rebuild that old dam, and it is navigable, if we're assuming that, you're going to have to get a permit to do that because you're going to be impounding that volume of water. There's no sort of grandfather, it was old, so I want to fix it kind of thing. But in my experience, TCEQ is, they're not the storm troopers. They are generally workable. You got to be sort of strategic in how you deal with them. But they're pretty understanding of the way that things go out in the country if you deal with it right.
Okay. Yes, sir.
All right, I guess it's my turn to talk about energy leases. So this is kind of going to cover broad spectrum, oil and gas, wind, solar, because we've got all those types of leasing going on in Texas right now. And feel free, I mean, I could, if you don't have any questions, I could ramble for 30 minutes, but feel free to stop me. Just a broad overview. They all get lumped together because oil and gas, wind power, solar power, it's all producing energy, all producing electricity, that sort of thing. They're similar in that respect, and that's about it. Oil and gas and wind have similarities. Somebody comes out, puts something on your property that's going to generate some energy, you can still go operate the property, plow around the oil well, plow around the wind turbine, so on and so forth. The guys are coming and going off your property. Those two are over here. The solar lease is way over here. A solar lease is more akin to a lease, to leasing out your property to build a shopping mall or a racetrack on it than it is to a wind lease or an oil lease.
I'm not telling you shouldn't lease some of your land out for solar energy. There may be some, it can be very lucrative financially. There may be some benefits to it. It may work within your operation. But once you lease that property to them and they start construction, it's done. You have that property as a income-generating asset. It is not a piece of real estate that you can use. It is a piece of real estate that somebody else is using entirely and paying you a potentially a pretty penny for that privilege. So just I want you to keep that in mind because, you know, I've had some clients who somebody wanted to lease, they own tens of thousands of acres, and somebody wanted to lease, you know, 1,000 acres for solar. I've had clients who, you know, they've had a, you know, they own several farms and they wanted to lease out one of them for solar, and that, you know, this will help make the whole operation cash flow. You know, I get that. That makes a lot of sense potentially from the dollars and cents perspective. I've got other people who, this is my family home place. It's the only place I own. Me and my grandson come out there and hunt on it, and they want to lease it out to solar. That's fine, but you no longer have access to that property. And if that's the only piece of property you own, that may make a whole lot of difference as opposed to if it's one of 10 parcels you own. So I just want you to think about that in context. And solar leasing is a lot like eminent domain, pipeline easements, that sort of thing. There's a big number going to be flashed at you, and it's going to sound great, and you're going to think, my gosh, these people are going to pay me $400 an acre to lease this out for solar when I might be able to get $30 for grazing or not anything for you know, thirds and quarters for cotton and wheat. That makes a lot of sense. It does, but you've also got to remember, these are 30, 40, 50, 60-year decisions that are going to outlast you. So you need to keep that in mind, good and bad. That may make it a better decision for you. Say, look, my kids are not ever going to operate this property, but they could sure use that income. Or you're going to saddle them with something that's, mom and dad, I really wanted to have that property. Yeah, you gave me a nice chunk of money, but I can't use the family property anymore. So you've got to think about these things. Just like pipeline easements, they're going to outlive you. So make sure it's a good decision for you as well as your kids and grandkids. Feel free to stop me at any time if you've got questions. I've got one right there. That is correct. So the solar leases, I've reviewed dozens of them. They all look different based on every country, every company that prepares one. They're all going to be extremely long and excessively wordy because it appears that those companies' lawyers get paid by the word. So there's a lot of that just is what it is. The main things you got to think about is what they're going to pay you during the option period, what they're going to pay you during when they build the solar lease. And then the other things we think about is minerals, because if you've got minerals under the property, then you may not be able to drill. You may have to give a surface waiver because they're not going to let you come drill a oil well and tear up a $100 million solar farm. If other people own the minerals on the property, have an interest in the minerals on the property, that's going to be a factor. We can address that in a minute. Water, sometimes they want to use your water. You know, that's okay. Don't give them unlimited right to use the water. They can pay you. They can get a tap from the rural water supply and pay their own water bill. Things to think about. And the other main important thing is property taxes. You will lose your ag use exemption. And I'm here to tell you, you should, because you can't run cattle on it. You can't operate ag. It's a property that's 100% devoted to energy production. You should lose your ag exemption. Your property taxes are going to go up in a big way. I have never had a company so far that did not agree to pay those taxes. I've never had one balk. I've had a couple of them go, oh, well, we didn't think about that. Let us evaluate early on. Now they all know that they're going to pay your taxes. If they refuse to pay that change in use, that's not somebody you want to do business with, I'm just telling you. But it's not just the change in use type. You're also going to get hit potentially for rollback taxes for 3 to 5 years for the change in use. So that's something I see all the time, that they agree to pay the taxes from the change in use, but they don't explicitly tell you that they'll reimburse you for or pay for the rollback taxes too. And I sent an email to a company this morning saying, hey, your taxes look good, but we need you to expressly say that you're going to pay the rollback taxes because I don't want my clients getting hit with that.
The other thing to think about real quick, on the other end of that, right, is if your land gets taken out of open space valuation for the 30 years while the solar farm is in there, the rules to get back in open space valuations, you've got to have ag use for 5 of the 7 years to get back in. So there's also going to be at least 5 years on the back end when it's over to get back into ag use valuation. So you may want to include that as well. Sorry.
So basically, you need to make it clear whether it's a lawyer who's looking at your sole release, whether it's me or somebody up here or somebody else entirely, make sure that the tax coverage is comprehensive, because that could that could cost a lot of money. If you look at what your property taxes are right now for, say, a section of land versus what it would be if they were taxing you at $1,000 an acre, $1,500 an acre, we're talking about several thousands of dollars a year in taxes to think about. Something else to think about on the solar aspect is make sure that if they are using a piece of your property but not all of it, make sure you're satisfied with where they're going to put. And this is one of the things I was working on in this email this morning, that you're satisfied with what the fences that they're going to put in. They're probably going to put a chain link fence up, something very expensive, something more expensive than what you you've got out there as a barbed wire fence. That's in my experience. But make sure that if they're going to build roads to you, if they're going to dig culverts, if they've got access easements across your property to that property, make sure those are located in such a way that are satisfactory to you. And that goes for wind, too. I'm negotiating some wind leases in my part of the world, and that's something that we've talked about. There are some horror stories of some guys who've had roads for wind turbines out farther west of me, out in kind of where all the wind turbines are, that these companies built roads right across terraces and cotton fields and that sort of thing, and the erosion is hideous. And they've got entire fields that are washing, and terraces are coming undone because they didn't have any control of where the roads were put. And I told this company that I was dealing with the other day, look, you're not putting a road on my client unless my client is in agreement where the road's going to be put. And this company, and this is why you got to be careful whether you're dealing with company representatives, landmen, whatever. This is a good discussion for oil and gas, pipeline, everything. If it's not in writing, it doesn't count. And I had these guys, the very first solar lease I ever discussed, had some guys that we were in a big group meeting. It was kind of a town hall, so to speak. It was three or four lawyers and our clients and some other landowners hearing from the company. Was kind of trying to answer a bunch of questions at once so they didn't have to answer it four or five times. And one of these guys, you know, he was a young, energetic, ambitious kid from Virginia. That's where the company's based out of. And, you know, he was really trying to help. And he said, you know, I just want y'all to know that I'm going to be with you every step of the way of the project. If you have any questions, you have any problem, you're not satisfied, you call me and I'll make sure it's taken care of. And one of these guys, who's about a 75-year-old cotton farmer, looked at him and said, son, that might mean something to me if you weren't the third guy that told me that on this project already. And the kid looked at him and said, I understand. Other thing to think about is I had this wind company tell me this about 2 months ago. These guys were in the song and dance routine about how they're friends of the landowner and friends of the farm and farmers and ranchers. And, you know, this company, you know, everybody's in this company is from, you know, these guys are from farm and ranch backgrounds and they care about agriculture. And one of the guys I wanted to ask him says, well, if you're so passionate about agriculture, why are you down here and not in Kansas where your family's from? And why are you an engineer and don't have any connection to your family farm and ranch? But I didn't go there. But they said, you know, these guys care. You know, they understand farm and ranch issues and they grew up in it and, you know, it matters to them. And I said, that's all well and good and I respect that and appreciate that. But what happens when your company sells this wind farm to the New York hedge fund that's a multi-billion dollar investment pool that has no idea where Stanford, Texas is and doesn't care? And the guy looked at me and goes, I understand, and tried to move on. So that's the thing, you're going to hear that. And those, for the most part, the guys that say that, they mean it when they say it, for the most part. Some of them are just outright liars. A lot of them are good guys that they genuinely mean that, but they're not going to be in control. So if it's not in writing in your lease and your pipeline easement, whatever it is, it doesn't count. It's not worth the paper it's printed on, which is none. So the other thing I want to talk about, and again, if you've got questions, none of these things are get-rich-quick schemes, and please don't think so. I had a, on this wind deal, these guys were running around telling everybody, you know, kind of how much money they're going to make on these wind turbines, because they're going to pay you three ways. They're going to pay you a per acre lease or a per megawatt charge based on how many turbines are on your property or a royalty. And I had a friend of mine who is just the kind of psychotic nerd who would do this sort of thing, who ran some models for me based on the nearest wind farm to this, and based on the data on how much wind electricity that wind farm was generating, based on the data that's provided to the federal government and the Department of Energy every year, and ran that based on this wind farm. And what we concluded is there was a 95% chance that these people were never going to get paid a wind royalty. They were going to get paid the per acre. They were going to get paid the per acre lease rate. You know, 5% royalty. You know, $2,000 per megawatt. Well, you may not have a turbine on you at all. You know, all those things sound good if it all works out. If the best possible scenario. We're all in agriculture. How many of you have ever had an agriculture investment situation in cow business or farming and rent, whatever, work out to the best possible scenario? Never. It's always the worst possible scenario. You better plan that way. And it looked to me like 95% of these time, these people can get paid $20, $25 an acre, ground lease rate, and that's it. And, you know, that's okay. That's going to help you pay your property taxes, maybe some insurance. That may be worth, they may decide that's a worthwhile addition to their income on their property. But it's a whole lot better than, you know, becoming the Jed Clampett of wind royalties and just raining cash down on you every month on your royalty checks. So just be aware of that and make it a smart decision, not a get-rich-quick decision.
We have a question right here.
James, I wanted to ask you a two-part question about solar, please. First of all, I've had some discussions with solar involved, and here's my question, basically. If the solar company fails, and now you've got a solar farm out there, and decommissioning and how that works, and I've heard some comments that anything from, well, the landowner would have the salvage value of what's there would be theirs to take care of, to take care of cleaning the place up versus buying bonds. What's the best protection for that, for the landowner? And then the second question that I have is mineral interest. Do all the mineral owners have to agree?
Okay, I'm going to handle the first one first. That's a really good question. That's a question I'm getting more and more. Solar is not like oil and gas, where we've had oil production in Texas for for 120 years, and we've all seen what happens when a lease terminates and everything's junked up. We're not there anywhere in solar production in Texas, to my knowledge. What I've told people is there's no good answer there. You're trying to taking a calculated risk. The solar company goes bankrupt while they're generating electricity. You know, I've got to remember, there are going to be private equity funds and hedge funds and multinational lenders that loaned hundreds of millions of dollars to finance this thing, that if the company goes bankrupt, the lenders are probably going to foreclose that thing, take it over and operate it as a solar plant or sell it to somebody else to another utility. So you've got to think that if the deal gets into production, that's probably going to happen because they've got multi-year, 30-year power purchase contracts before they agreed to build this thing, otherwise they wouldn't have done it. So I think you can, I'm not going to say that's a guarantee, but I think you can have that in your mind. But what happens when they get to the end of the lease term, or what happens if the government cuts the legs out from underneath some of the tax credits that make these things go? I wish I had a good answer for you. You know, trying to get some sort of, we always put in these terms, that in these leases that, they've got 180 days to clean the property up, restore it to its use. What if nobody's around to do that? Yeah, the landowner's got the salvage use, but who's got the money to go and the equipment to haul it off and pay the salvage on it? If you can get them to put a performance bond in there and require and then to post a performance bond for you to clean it up, and if you don't, you can cash in the bond. Like the Railroad Commission makes an oil and gas operator if they abandon a well that needs plugging. That's great. That's what you try to do. I've had some companies just say, nope, not going to do it. Sorry, our lenders won't let us do it. That's the thing that you got to try to push for. I don't think it's a guarantee that you can get it done, but that's what you got to try to do. And to some degree, you're taking a calculated risk that I'm generating this income on my property, and that there's a 5% chance this thing may fail and I may have a mess on my hands in the, 30 years from now. So that's just something I think you could go into it eyes wide open, and I'm glad people are asking that question so you are aware there. Second question on minerals. Companies are going to make every mineral owner, whether a royalty owner or whatever, sign a surface waiver of some sort, or they're going to try to buy those minerals out. Tiffany and I have gotten into this question before. if you have the executive rights on the property over somebody else's non-participating royalty interest, whether it's a family member or some severed interest out there, you better be careful, because there are lawyers in Texas who will contend that as a landowner, you have, or as an executive rights owner, you have a fiduciary duty to those royalty owners, a fiduciary duty to lease out for oil and gas. Because I had a dispute with that one time where the guy was like, well, fine, I'm not going to, because he was mad that he didn't have any part of the royalty. He said, well, I'm not going to lease that out ever again. They can do that over my dead body. And other lawyers saying, if you do that, we'll sue you for violating your fiduciary interest. When it comes to oil and gas on that, I don't know. I think that's debatable. When it comes to solar, and you are basically foreclosing the ability to develop that land for oil and gas, and you're the one that whose pocket is going to be enriched at the expense of those non-participating royalty owners, yes, you do have some liability there, and you need to be aware of that. One of the things we try to do on a larger project is set aside some drill sites within the project where we can just predetermine those as part of the lease, that look, if there ever is an oil and gas lease and this is block, this is where they're going to drill the well for it. And companies, for the most part, might have to wrangle with them a little bit, but they will get along and understand that. So those are the things to think about.
Okay, stop.
Hold on. The oil company or the solar company is generally going to want that. But sometimes they're going to want you to help them do that work. They can do that. They got land men. They've got a budget. They'll pay the land men to go figure out who those mineral owners are and track them down. That's not something you have to do. If it's your brother, you can tell them that.
We're going to have to take the mic away from James. Okay, we have three questions.
Yes. We have three questions. Question number one.
Okay, right here. James and Tiffany. Tiffany, you just wrote about my topic question here is wind turbines, and are they a nuisance? So here's the question. So is there any legal recourse for somebody that's got a 10-acre with a $300,000 house on it that now is in not possession, but has now a nice set of wind turbines within a half a mile of the house? You know that the market value of that property and house has now gone down. Is there any legal recourse?
That's a good question. So what I wrote about is there is pretty solid case law in Texas that if you are complaining about the site of wind turbines, you don't like the aesthetic problem, Texas courts have said that's not a nuisance. It's not a nuisance to not like what the wind turbines look like. Now, generally, and I've said this about solar, I've got a lot of calls on solar too. I don't want my neighbor to have a solar farm. How do I stop him? I think the general rule is people have the right to be stupid with their own property. Okay, you may not like it, but they have the right to do what they want on there generally. The exception to that is if they do something on their property that substantially interferes with your use and enjoyment of your own property. Okay? So that's the economist in you asking the value question, okay? So for example, if you're next to a wind turbine and your complaint isn't, I don't like how it looks or I don't like what it does to my property value, but the noise of that wind turbine is making me crazy or something like that, right? Or the blinking light, right? Those sort of things. I think that there might be a potential nuisance claim. I'm not going to tell you you would win. There's a potential maybe there. But from the perspective of I don't like how they look, it's hurting my property value, I do not think there'll be a successful nuisance case there. That's not what you wanted me to know.
And let me just say the property value is something you need to factor in, because you may be, you know, you're going to get a big windfall money, a wind royalty or whatever, but your property value is going to decrease. And some realtors will tell you as much as 40%. So that $25 an acre, when you think about the value of the property impacting your net worth, that may matter to you. Number two, and this is just my personal preference, if I've got a I could see a wind farm from 25 miles away. Solar farms are ugly as sin, but you really can't see them until you drive right up on them. So that's something to think about. I mean, if it's right in your backyard, that's one thing. But if it's, you know, two farms over, that may be something to think about if you're the neighbor.
Last question right here.
Sir, you mentioned pertaining to solar leases. Once you lease out that property, you no longer have access or rights to that property. So say you were to lease a section of land, 640 acres, and they only required 50% of that land for the solar operation, could you not lease cattle or graze cattle on the remainder of that land? Or is that something that you simply cannot do, or could you work on that in the lease?
Well, what you may do is they may take an option to lease the whole section, and then they'll select what they want to build on.
Right.
And at that point, they the rest of it drops away. It's like an oil and gas option that they don't exercise. They just take the solar on the, they're only going to lease and pay you for what they're actually producing solar on. Now, I had a client the other day down around Houston who they were going to, we gave a mandatory minimum provision on this property because if they didn't lease the whole thing or pretty close to it, they're going to make the property worthless for the guy. You know, he's got 500 acres and we got some wetland over here and he's not going to take 25 acres and be able to do anything with it. And he told them it's an all or nothing provision and they agreed to that. But if they exercise the lease on it and they're paying you $200, $400, $600 an acre or whatever, then it's theirs. They're fencing it off. You don't have access to it.
But just to be clear, you can negotiate anything with them. I mean, you can negotiate the right to still use whatever. He's just telling you generally solar companies are going to say, look, these things are worth $100 million. You're not coming in there. And you've seen pictures of, like, goats grazing underneath the solar panels, right? There are some companies that might sign up to do that. I've not talked to any of them. They think you're crazy if you ask.
Same
so.
Here. Same here.
Thank you.
Do you have another one back here? No. Okay.
We had one fell over here.
Okay, we'll take one more, and then we've got to switch topics again. Any more? Okay. Here she comes with the mic.
The oil companies, I'm from Karnes County, a lot of drilling there. Oil companies are allowed to pump water out of the San Antonio River. Have you ever seen a paper that gave them the right to pump all the water they want out of that San Antonio River and farmers can't get irrigation rights?
Jim?
I mean, there is a special provision for oil and gas on surface water rights, but it's not a open season. I mean, just throw your all pump right on the side of the water. Asked, they've got to have rights for it.
I've asked lawyers before, can you show me where they got that right, when they got it? And
well,
I've never gotten an answer.
I mean, the special provision that they have is by statute, okay, where they get treated specially under the water code in terms of rights. But they have to have a right. They've got to have rights from somebody to pull that water. They can't just throw a pump down and say, we're oil and gas, okay? So if they're withdrawing that much water out of there, they've got to have somebody's water rights. Call TCEQ.
Can they buy these rights from a landowner who has irrigation rights?
Yes. That's commonly
so
how
that's
it happens.
That's how they get it?
That's commonly how it happens, is they look up on that registry I was talking about to this lady back here and buy rights or lease those rights.
Okay, we're going to switch gears. Now we're going to go to fence law. Kyle is our resident fence law expert down here on the end.
Well, thank you, Tiffany. I don't know if I'm an expert, but I'm going to do my best. Before I get going, I want to give a shout-out to a handbook that's on Tiffany's helpful ag law page. A couple years ago, I guess it was probably 2.5 years ago, Tiffany, Jim, and myself got together and wrote a book on fence law. It's called Five Strands. And so everything we're going to be talking about for the next 30 minutes is in that handbook. And would highly recommend, you know, if you have other questions, taking a look on that. And that's on Tiffany's webpage, which I'm sure we'll have access to at some point. So fence law in Texas. First rule, Texas is an open range state, which means that since the 1800s, Texas has had the stance that if you own livestock in Texas, there's no legal obligation to keep those animals on your property. It's open range. They can roam wherever they want to. Now, obviously, y'all didn't see any cows out in the water gardens across the street from the convention center, so obviously that's not the case everywhere. So baseline rule is Texas is open range. You can allow your animals to roam wherever, and that traces its roots back to cattle drives and whatnot. There's two exceptions to the open range rule. The first exception is what's considered a stock law. And so on a county-by-county basis, the state legislature has allowed counties to enact what are called stock laws, which, so we're here in Tarrant County, for example, and they may have what's called a stock law that they enacted maybe in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that says if you own livestock by species, so if you own cattle, sheep, horses, goats, you are required to fence, so you keep them fenced in on your property. And so what this stock law does is it converts the Tarrant County from being an open range county to it is now a closed range county, meaning if you own those animals, you have a legal obligation to make sure that they stay on your property. And I would say, I believe there's 25 or something counties in Texas that In 1981, the state legislature said that a stock law cannot be enacted in those counties. And they're all over. They're not just out in West Texas. There's some of them in East, some South, some West Texas. But for those counties, and again, they're listed in that Five Strands book. They're considered open range counties still. So the first exception, as I said, is the stock laws. The second exception is if you have property that abuts a U.S. or state highway, and which is common sense. I mean, we don't want to have, as livestock owners, we don't want our animals to get hurt or, killed by motorists. We don't want to kill any motorists. So if you have property that abuts, I-20 going out west to, into Parker County, or if you have, a state 281 going south to Stephenville or something, those are the types of properties that if you have property that abuts that type of roadway, you have to fence your property. So that's considered a closed range area. An important thing to note there is that doesn't apply to county roads or your FM farm to market roads. So if you are in, just to give you an example, if you're in Palo Pinto County, which is just west of here, that is still considered an open range county. And if you have, if your property is on a farm to market road, you have no legal obligation per statute to keep your animals on your property. And again, it's pertinent. It's a smart thing to do to make sure you have your animals on your property. But from a negligence or a liability issue, if your cow got on the road, the county road, and somebody hit it, you would not be. I guess there's something. I'm not gonna say you'd never be liable because we're always gonna have an answer as it depends as a lawyer. But you're unlikely to be liable in that situation, and we'll get into some questions on that here in a second. The next thing I want to mention on fences is so Jim and I are neighbors, and I would like to build a new fence, and the fence we have there is in pretty poor shape, and I'm tired of his cows getting on my property. Can I say, Jim, will you go in half with me and build a new good 7-strand barbed wire fence? In Texas, there's no legal, from a legal standpoint, obligation for me to make Jim help me pay for that fence. I'll pay for it all. Yeah. So that's something that a lot of people are unaware of is, you expect that if we're both getting benefit out of that fence that he should help me out. But in Texas, there's no legal obligation to split that. James was talking about oil and gas operations. And the importance of entering into, leases and surface use agreements with those oil and gas operators. Oil and gas operators in Texas have no legal, they're not legally required to fence around their oil derricks or their, pumps, their pads. And if your animals were to get on, to those operations and get injured in some aspect, again, legally in Texas, there's no, they're not required to put a fence around that pad site. So it would be important if you can enter into a service use agreement with that oil and gas operator and say, hey, will you make sure you put a fence around your operations so that my animals don't get on your property? Trying to think of what other things you want to cover, Tiffany, before we open up for questions. Is that,
I think that's good. We can go back to our guy who was excited.
The first question here, so you were asking, you said you've got a new neighbor, you have a nice 7-strand fence, and they're wanting to do a high fence for a game ranch. Is that correct?
Well, the place is for sale, but everyone's looked at it. We want to put up a high fence for exotics. And say this fence isn't very old, and I'd hate to have it tore down and replaced. I mean, can I stop that?
So yeah. Tiffany, you want to talk about your new statute?
Yeah, the answer is probably yes. So actually in Texas, there's a statute called the Texas Fence Removal Statute. And what that says is if you're dealing with a jointly owned boundary fence, you cannot tear that down without mutual permission from the parties on both sides, if it's jointly owned, okay? Now, most boundary fences are going to be. What is a situation where it would be only one of you owned a boundary fence? It's what Kyle just said. If Jim won't share in the costs to build a boundary fence and Kyle pays to build it all, that's now Kyle's fence. It's not jointly owned anymore, okay? Most of the time, that's not the situation, and a boundary fence is jointly owned, and they cannot tear that down under that Texas fence removal statute. Now, could they come build a high fence statute 6 inches into their property? Sure, they can do that, but they would likely not be able to tear that one down that's already there.
Well, let me tell you one thing. Texas landowners are generally unfamiliar with the requirements of the statutes, okay? And the point is that that doesn't mean somebody's not going to do something stupid. It happens every day. So, but that's the law. I mean, so you're protected in that situation, but people just make all kinds of random decisions and judgments out there in the pasture that think, well, you know, I'm putting up a new fence, I'll just tear out the old fence, and then they get a fence contractor to do it. So, I mean, if you think that's a potential and somebody buys that piece of property, I'd knock on their door, buy them a cup of coffee or something, and say, by the way, this is my fence and sure hate to see it torn down, and some lawyers in Fort Worth told me blah, 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 blah.
And for the record, when they do something stupid, they always call the lawyer afterwards. Never before.
Do we have any other fence? Okay, we got one.
I have a property line fence built between me and my neighbor in 1972. He agreed to pay for half of the material. He wanted me to drive San Antonio to Calderson's to save 10 cents a post. I told him, no, you go and drive to it. No, no, go ahead and get it. So I bought the material in Corn City. He never paid me for the material. Is that my fence? Now he's deceased. His son owns it. If his son wants to tear it down, he has no right to tear it down unless he gets permission from me. Is that correct?
So you, just to make sure I'm hearing you correctly, you said that you paid for the fence yourself, that he...
I paid for all the wire, all the posts, and he never paid me for any of it.
Okay, yes, sir. That's not going to be a common fence that's shared between both landowners. That's going to be a fence that is owned solely by you. So to answer your question, your neighbor's son couldn't come on there and tear it down without your... without your permission. One question I do want to, I'm going to set Tiffany up here. A question we get a lot is, so Tiffany and I are neighbors, and I have some really nice Hereford heifers, and she's got a rangy, bull that, and the example I was giving her is like out of the Ghost Riders in the Sky song by Johnny Cash, you know, it's pretty ragged looking. And he's pretty excited that I put these, you know, these heifers next to his pasture. Next thing you know, he's in there and he's bred all my heifers. What type of liability, Tiffany? What are my options with my neighbor here?
You notice the good bull never breeds the crappy cows. It never happens that way, right? No, this is a question, and I'm glad Kyle asked it because I think this is something where the law probably doesn't fit with the common sense we think the way it should apply in certain circumstances. It goes back to Kyle's explanation before. You got to know, are you an open range county or a closed range county? If you're a closed range county, that means the bull owner had an obligation not to permit his bull to run at large. Okay? So if I'm in an open range county, that bull owner is potentially liable for that bull getting over onto my property. And that liable means he could be liable for damages. Well, if there's damages, you know, to the heifers, either what I could have gotten if I had bred them to the bull I bred them to, or sometimes, right, big bull gets in, breeds the heifers, we lose a bunch of heifers calving, same thing there. If the neighbor permitted them to run at large, now I didn't say he automatically is going to recover money, okay? The question's going to look at the facts there, right? What was the quality of the fence? Was the fence in disrepair? How many times had the bull been out before? All those sort of things. So that's the analysis in a closed range county. I think that makes sense to most of us. Where this gets confusing and doesn't make a lot of sense is in an open range county where that bull owner has no obligation to keep his bull in his pasture. There's just no duty there. So generally in an open range county, there would be no liability to a bull owner in Kyle's scenario. Okay, there's a couple of exceptions. One of those exceptions, again, this is just open range. One of those exceptions is if the landowner knows that bull is diseased, or this is going to sound dumb, but this is the word they use, or vicious, like tears down fences. If the landowner knows that, he can be liable, even in an open range county, okay? Or if you're in an open range county and you as the neighbor built a sufficient fence to keep the bull out, and there's statutory explanation of what a sufficient fence is. For barbed wire, what is it called? Like four strands?
Yes, three strands. It's very minimum. I mean, it's a very
it's pretty
low
yeah.
bar.
Your fence will be better than that. But anyway, if you have built a fence to keep them out in an open range county and the bull still gets in, you can potentially be liable there. All right, so again, it's going to depend on if you're open range or closed range, how that plays out. Okay, we've got one over here.
Just two thoughts to throw in the hopper here for the next question that I want to underscore. I mean, how in terms of protection and potential for lawsuits, this is a big deal right now. I've gotten 4 or 5 calls a year. There's an outfit running around Texas that when somebody is injured at night by hitting an animal that got out, you know, this whole ambulance chasing thing, there's bull out chasing, okay? And it's a big deal because if one of these things happens, it's usually pretty serious and somebody is killed or somebody is seriously hurt. And so the point I want to make to producers is there's a group going around shopping these things, right? And they have an expert that they're using. And so your producers are getting sued. And then the expert is coming and looking at your fences and checking them out and saying these aren't adequate and stuff. And I'm just telling you this to be aware of it because I bet I've got 5 calls last year, different parts of the state with local lawyers representing the landowners. But then this expert's coming in who is a fence law expert. So if you've got areas of your fence that are loose, you've got animals that are getting out consistently in a particular area, you need to address that because what has happened in the past and what has been allowed to happen by you, that's going to be fair game in the event that you're in the lawsuit or something like that. So pay real attention to this.
And buy liability insurance.
Yeah, we talked about that this morning extensively. One other thing I'll say here, and then we'll go to your question. I'm so sorry. You give a lawyer a microphone, right? Everything's gone to... Anyway. No, one other point that I'll make on that, what Jim is saying there... What was I going to say? I had something really important. It was so important. I'll keep thinking about it, and hopefully it'll come back to me. Go ahead.
The open range, closed range issue is very difficult to determine in most counties, and it may even vary by precinct. And those records can be buried in minutes. And so digging that up can be very difficult at times. The question is for the testing the new guy. I bought and paid for and built my new three-strand barbed wire fence. I didn't pay for a survey. It's 6 inches on the other side of the line. Who owns the fence?
All right, here we go. Okay, so first, just comment. Spending extra money to get a survey is critical because you can have issues. This is going to be what's coined as adverse possession with your neighbor. So that fence you own because you put it on there, but you don't own those 6 inches of property that's on your neighbor's property. That's still your neighbor's property. Now the issue is going to happen is if your neighbor, for example, is unaware of that or maybe is aware of it, but 10 years from now, you know, or you know, 15 years from now, who owns that 6 inches? And it's maybe not a big deal if it's just 6 inches, but what if it's, you know, 50 yards. That becomes a bigger issue. So to answer your question, you own the fence, but I would, I would talk to your neighbor and make sure they're aware that you're aware of what's happened, because you could have an issue or a lawsuit, let's say in the future, with your neighbor saying, hey, he took my land, and that could be a potential issue in the future, especially, you know, after you've been using that fence for a while. Adverse possession is a kind of a difficult area of the law because there's a lot of different factors in terms of, you know, were both parties aware of the fact that you were adversely possessing that person's property? You know, did your neighbor just kind of sit on his rights and he should have said, hey, that's my property, you need to move your fence? And I think legally, he probably has every right to make you move your fence, if you know, because that's his property, you know, that's his land. So I think having an agreement or understanding with your neighbor on that fence and where it's at would be my recommendation. But you own the fence, but as of right now, I think that's still his property. Y'all have any other back me up on that?
Did you do that, Charles?
No.
You just made it up. All right. I was checking you.
You didn't know it was going to be a test, did you?
Well, I didn't know. But, I mean, you own the fence, but you own the problem, you know, and then you've got a problem. I think you can fix it with an encroachment agreement without going and pulling up every one of those T-posts, but you better take some money or whiskey with you to your neighbor to get them to sign that thing.
I remember my brilliant thought.
We're all waiting.
It just took a minute.
Yeah,
I know.
All
it's
waiting.
Really good. No, so we were talking about, right, he was saying one of the things that courts look at, if we have cattle out on the highway that get hit, right, they start looking at the facts to see things like, again, what was the quality of your fence? How long have they been out? How many times have they been out before? All that's really important. I was talking to a woman in East Texas not too long ago, and she was saying they had a situation where her neighbor's black cattle kept getting out on the road, and the sheriff would call her. They're not her cattle, but the sheriff would call her, and she would in turn call the neighbor, or she would go help get them in, whatever. She's being a good neighbor, right? Well, eventually, her cattle actually did get out, okay? And when the lawyer for the other side goes and pulls the sheriff's logs, what does he see? 25 calls to her that her cattle are out on the highway. If that ever happens, if they call and they're not your cattle or whatever, you need to call back and tell them to log it in the sheriff's log, log it yourself, because that lady got in a world of trouble in a situation where she was trying to be a good neighbor and didn't realize that could be a problem.
We have one more question.
Let me just say before we do that, on the fencing, on the boundary issue, before you build a fence, please go get a survey. I own a title insurance company. I hire a lot of surveys done. Most surveys are, unless it's a really big, really complicated property, they're a lot cheaper than you can build a mile worth of fence. So surveys are worth their weight in gold, but get a good surveyor, not a surveyor who asks you where you want him to set the corners. I know some surveyors like that. I've had some clients who that came in handy for them at a time. But generally speaking, you want the surveyor to set the corners where they are, not where they want to be. And if they deviate from what you think is a common boundary fence or what has been the boundary fence for a long time, I would say that you probably have a fence that's older than 20 years. They're all off. I mean, that's what it is. So just before you go spend $10,000, $15,000 a mile building a fence, make sure you've got a survey.
All right, I own some property that's in East Texas. My granddad had bought it back in the 40s. Then it became my dad's and is now mine. Dad did not have a survey on it. It became his in the 50s. I tried to get a survey while Dad was still living. But then once Dad passed, I was able to convince my mother to get a survey of the property. And when the property was surveyed, basically the fence lines on the east and north were a foot inside our property, and the property on the south and west were a foot outside the property. And like I say, it's the same fence. Some places it still had some of the old 1940s barbed wire on it, and then other places of it they put hog wire and other stuff up. But then we had a problem with a new neighbor on the east side had sold the property. By the deed, they had said that it went to the fence line, which was a foot our side. And then they built a fence, and then they tied off in between the posts rather than setting a post. And then we've just had different circumstances with that. But is it very unusual? Well, let me ask. Well, my question is I've had the survey, and it's been a survey, but it was not an electronic GPS survey. Do I need to have a resurvey to be GPS, or is the survey that was done that I did file with the county still valid?
I think your old survey is good. I mean, there's no requirement to get an upgraded GPS or anything. If that surveyor knew what he was doing, which sounded like he did, because it sounds like a perfect square, it was just off a foot, or the fences are off a foot evenly all around, that survey is still good. And, I mean, you have the issue with the fence being over on that one, and then you've got, I mean, you still own the property on the one-foot side outside the fence. I think you said the north and the east there, so it's your property. The issue is, you know, for whatever reason, some lawyer did a deed based on a legal description of where the fence is at. I don't know anybody would do that, but, you know, it was convenient, but it was wrong. But, I mean, you don't have to go redo that survey. You're good with that survey as it is.
And if you were to go get that survey, a new survey done with GPS, it would probably come out a little different than that old survey. I've seen some old, really, really good surveys that I knew that, you know, I've seen the surveyor's trail of work behind him, and I'd trust his survey as long as it went. But he didn't have GPS, and somebody new did, so it's just going to look a little different. And that's just.
Or another aspect, too, on this. When my granddad bought the land, it was measured in varas. And then when it was inherited by Dad, it remained in varas. And then when it came to Mom, that's when I said, we need to get it out of the Texas varas and into yards. So that was the main part of it, because it was the old deed in the varas rather than in the yards.
That is correct. And there's two, and you get tons of old surveys in Texas reference varas, and there's actually two different varas calculations. If you look online, you calculate, use one, because one was used in Texas and one was used elsewhere, and correct, I've been too long since I looked at it, but we're going to have two different links. They're slightly different. So yeah, if you can get it updated like that, that's always helpful. You would not believe the bad surveys that we see that reference a small mesquite tree for corner. I hope that mesquite tree is still small, but that was 1911, so I'm not sure.
Okay, we've got one in the front, and then I think there's one in the back, maybe. Oh, and one over here, too. Okay. We're okay.
Okay, so if you were in a situation where somebody were to sell property and split it into two pieces, so you have two new landowners, and they've talked about putting up a boundary fence on the boundary line, but they can't agree on what type of fence or what cost for the materials, and one of them just goes ahead and puts up a fence, is it just whoever puts up the fence, the other person can't tear it down, or can they fight that since they were living there at the same time that person was?
I've never had that question. We've done this a lot. I've never had that question before. I assume it's a race to the fence, right? I mean, I can't imagine that there's no rule that one side has precedent over the other. So I think it would be whoever builds it first is going to now own that fence and can't tear it down. That's my guess. I've never heard that question. Anybody?
I mean, I think it's really answered by if you get out there. I don't know if it's a race to fence, because usually people aren't in a hurry to build fence. But if you build it and you have the materials there, as Tiffany said at the beginning, or Kyle too, is that's really your fence. Now, it's a really good question, and we like good ones because we get some of the same old ones, and that's new. I mean, I think you could have an issue with your neighbor if you didn't ask them. They may say, well, yeah, I would have paid half, but you didn't call me. You got real horsey and went out there and did it on your own. But the general rule is if you paid for it, you put it there. If you put it on the boundary line, that's your personal property there, which I think is the answer to the question.
And if I had a client asking me where to put that fence, I would not put a fence on the boundary line unless I had some sort of boundary line agreement with that party or shared they'd paid for it. If I had to move it over 2 inches inside my property line and tell my fence builder, put those fences, you know, have the surveyor stake it off every 50 feet and do that, I would put the fence, if I'm paying fully for the fence, I would put it inside my property line, even if just, because if it's inside my property line, nobody can tell me what to do. If it's on the boundary, then there's always a potential. And, you know, not everybody's going, everybody has a different definition. I mean, how many people in this room is how many definitions of what constitutes a good fence? So, yeah, so shared fences are a dangerous game to begin with, because everybody's going to have an idea of how many strands to use, how good the barbed wire is, and so on.
Good? Okay, in the back.
Back to the cattle getting out on the highway. If you, if the person leases a place and it's not his fence, but he puts his cattle on it, his cattle, and the fence is kind of bad, and the landowner doesn't want to replace the fence or repair it, and his cattle gets out on the highway, gets hit, somebody gets killed, then what kind of insurance do you have to buy to cover that? Who would be responsible for taking care of the fence, and who would be liable, the landowner or the man leasing the land for his cattle?
Okay, well, so two things. First of all, both the landowner and the tenant should have liability insurance. And I think liability insurance as a tenant is something that we overlook. It's not very expensive to get. So we lease property. We always have liability insurance on that property in case our cattle get out. Because the answer is, who's going to get sued? Both of us, right? Plaintiff's lawyer is going to sue everybody they can think of. So you just need liability insurance on however many acres you have leased, and it's not super expensive to get. I'd have that as a landowner and a tenant. As far as who's likely going to be liable if something happens, let me back up. As far as who's responsible to build the fence depends on your lease. That is something you need to address in the lease. Who's responsible to repair and maintain fences? There's no big set law on that in Texas, and so it's something you need to negotiate and put in a lease agreement. Absent something in a lease that says it's the landowner that has to fix it, then the liability for the cattle being out would be on the tenant. The general rule is the tenant is the one liable during the term of a lease if something happens. So from a tenant perspective, it's on you, liability-wise, to make sure that those fences are sufficient to keep those cattle in. And I know that that's crap from a tenant perspective, right? Because you're going to go repair this fence, and then when the lease is over, you got to walk away. You're better to do that. Or in a perfect world, you're going to negotiate with the landowner and get some sort of split, right? Back where I'm from, it's fairly common for guys to do a lease where they'll share the cost. One of them provides the materials, the other one provides the labor. On a fence like that, if you can get a deal like that, terrific. If your landowner is going to be a jerk and say, I'm not helping you, you still better figure out a way to have good fences or put up a hot wire or something, because you're the one that would be on the hook liability-wise if those cattle got hit on the highway. If you're in a closed range area. If you're in an open range county, everything I just said goes out the window because you don't have any duty to keep them in anyway. Make sense? Okay.
Unless it's a U.S. or state highway.
That's a good point. I need to go back to that. I'm sorry. Okay.
You're fine. I've got four more.
Figuring out if you're open range or closed range can be difficult. There's no database where you go pull it up. In a perfect world, I'm going to make one of those. I'm working on it. Okay. What I would do is this. The first thing I would do is talk to my county sheriff, county attorney, county judge, county clerk. The hope is they have dealt with this question before and somebody's pulled it and knows the answer. Okay. If they don't, if you have a local stock law, it's going to be in the commissioner court records. A lot of them were passed in the 1900s. And you got to go back through commissioner court records that show the election results. They're in like cursive handwriting and try to dig them up. But I'd start with that sheriff, attorney, judge, county clerk and see if they know. Okay, okay, over here.
On fencing and property ownership, that we have some old Texas land grants and boroughs that agree with the GLO and county records as far as property lines and all, but that's not necessarily where the fences are. Fences may be on high banks of creeks or ravines, maybe on the other side of the creek. What dictates the ownership? Is it the fence lines or is it the survey? The surveys haven't been done during any of the current owners and from clear back probably in the 60s.
So a fence line does not, where a fence is does not ever automatically change property lines, ever. Property lines are property lines. I don't care where you build a fence. The only way that a fence could potentially change ownership of property is if one of the parties could go to court and file a lawsuit for adverse possession, which is also called squatter's rights, and basically claim adverse possession of the property that was under their fence, even though it was yours. But they would have to go to court and actually prove that, and particularly when you're dealing with like grazing cattle, very tough case to prove adverse possession. I'm not going to say you can never do it, but it's real tough to do. But just there's no automatic change in boundary lines based on where a fence is.
And I have clients all the time say, or not all the time, but have had clients say, well, I can just prove ownership by adverse possession. Well, yeah, you can. But we've got to go to court to do that and prove a lawsuit, and I'll need a retainer for $50,000 because that's what it's going to cost you. That's the worst possible scenario on that. You know, you can use adverse possession, you know, limitations, affidavits, if property's been abandoned and nobody's around and we're just trying to clear up a property that's not worth anything. When you get into boundaries, it's really difficult. And it's going to take some sort of active, open you attempt to claim that property from the neighbor, and I don't think there's any way you could prove just moving the fence because of erosion is going to do that.
And in fact, if grazing cattle was the use you were trying to prove for adverse possession, you would actually have to build your own fence. You couldn't rely on somebody else having built a fence that was off. So very hard to prove that. the person using the property that did not own it would be the person that would want to claim adverse possession. Yeah. Okay, one last fence question. Oh, we got... Okay.
We actually have one here, one over here.
All right, we're going to do two more fence questions, and then if you have any more, we'll catch you at the end. We got 30 minutes. Jim had something you wanted to say. Uh-oh, Jim's still talking.
No. Jim's still talking, as usual. I was just going to say, it's an interesting point that occurred to me. We believe it or not, the Texas Supreme Court right now has got a fence law case in front of it. Classic scenario where a bull gets out, gets hit, somebody gets injured. The facts are the bull got through the gate somehow, or the gate was latched, but it was not locked. That's the big issue, and it's in front of the Texas Supreme Court. This organization, TSCRA, has, with a couple of other groups, filed a brief with the Supreme Court because we don't entirely trust that judges understand fences and cows. But it's a big, that's a big issue. They're going to decide that case. And it's over this highway standard versus the closed range standard. The Court of Appeals that decided the case botched it and really confused that standard. So the outcome of that case is going to be very, very important for all of us in determining what the law is going forward.
Okay, we'll take the two more, then we'll move on. Whoever.
Okay, this gentleman's question is, are there any certain specifics that make a hot wire fence legal or illegal?
No, there's no standards on there's no standards to build a hot wire fence. From a liability standpoint, I know of at least one case in the panhandle where they said a one-strand hot wire fence was sufficient enough to keep cows in. So I don't know of any rules about what you how you have to build a hot wire fence. There's no rules on that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Our question on the eminent domain, which you mentioned, along the southwest property boundary was an old railroad grade from the 1890s, and my granddad used it to ship his crop to Dallas. But then over the years in the 60s, the grade was abandoned, and it's 100 foot wide, running the whole south-southwest length of this property. Pretty much myself and a neighbor across the way who I lease my land to graze for him to graze his cattle. He's been using it for the cattle to come up to get to my property and back. And we've actually been in contact with the current owner of the railroad because we have a copy of the deeds from the 1890s and subsequent. But the thing is, further south and also further north, there's a lot of people who have actually fenced completely across the 100-foot-wide railroad grade. And in one place, they've actually got part of their house built across it. So where we have been saying it's the railroad, and we've contacted the railroad, and that it's theirs, and we're just using it to let you all know that we're letting our cattle walk along that. But is there any problem for us having cattle traverse from his property to my property across the 100-foot-wide railroad grade?
So I don't know that. I mean, providing the railroad notice of what you're doing and if they're okay with it, I don't see why there'd be a legal type issue there. Again, talking about adverse possession, it's a very fact and factor specific type area, and you have to go to court to prove it. So just having y'all being in agreement on how you're going to move your cattle and using some of it and not using some of it and letting the railroad know that you're using it and then pretty much consenting for that use. You don't own that property, but I don't see, they could definitely tell you to not use it if they wanted to. So I don't know if there's an issue for how it stands right now.
And just as a general rule, I could do 15 minutes on my problems with the title messes created out of railroad right-of-ways and abandoned railroads, because they were originally granted in most cases to look like a right-of-way over and across your property, and then after they abandoned the railroad, you should have reverted back to the landowner, but then the railroad companies just started selling it off like it's fee simple ownership. So be careful if you're building anything on railroad right-of-way is all I'll say.
Okay, let's move to eminent domain, which is probably why most of you came in this room. I got nods in the back. She's like, finally. Okay, Jim, take us away.
Okay, I'm going to turn what has been a really civilized discussion into I'm just going to throw gas on fire here.
eminent domain, most of you probably don't need any introduction. How many of you all have been impacted by eminent domain directly on your property? I'm sorry for that. But let me kick this off. This is an enormous issue for this organization, for landowner groups statewide. It's a function of a number of things. One, the just explosion of oil and gas production in the state, which has been a very, very bountiful thing. But you all know, for every well, there is a pipeline, and for every pipeline, there is something else, and it moves on and on and on. The leading edge of eminent domain is the Permian out there, which is setting world records for production. And we're at a point now where all of that, they've got a lot of production stranded out there due to lack of pipeline capacity. So we are at the beginning of a tidal wave of very large pipelines that are going to begin moving product from the Permian Basin to Corpus Christi, which is kind of becoming a new hub, and to Houston. So that is going to throw a lot of projects on a lot of landowners real fast. There's another source of this. It's not just oil and gas. It is the growth of Texas. As people are moving to these huge super cities like here in the Metroplex, Houston, the I-35 corridor, think about it a little bit. You've got to have more power. You've got to have more water. You've got to have more roads. It's on and on and on. And we don't have a magic reservoir of unused property that belongs to the state in Texas. Every one of those projects is going to take place on somebody's private property. Every one of them. So this, the amount of eminent domain is a big factor. The second biggest factor is the state of the law in eminent domain, which is deplorable. Landowners are inadequately protected by current laws. I'm not going to go deeply into that. If you're up, have your coffee and your breakfast in the morning at 9:25, come on, and I'll give you a 101 on where things are. But we want to answer your question here today. But it's a big issue. So what do you do as a landowner when you get the knock on the door, that nice guy who always, always starts the conversation by, I love your cows, my grandfather ran cows. I mean, I'm to a T, right? To a T. Yeah. Right, and then it just goes south from there. But easements are a very complicated deal, and many of you are presented with those things. How do you negotiate an easement? What's the strategy? What do you do to protect yourself? And that's what this little half-hour session is to talk about. You know, what experiences you've had or what questions. I'll give a plug for Tiffany down here. She has a wonderful publication out there on oil and gas pipelines, which is a checklist. And I'm telling you, that document alone, which is free on the internet, if you follow that and negotiate that, you will have probably an easement that is in the form that's the top 10% of the quality of landowner easement. So it's out there for free to take a look at. Question?
Yeah, question, maybe a Tiffany question based on something you said earlier. This notion of nuisance from wind towers or Crestlines to me. You talk about there's not any law, statutory or case law either, I guess, for this nuisance problem.
So in what the courts in Texas have said is we do not recognize a claim of aesthetic nuisance. So in other words, if you don't like the look of something, that is not going to qualify for a nuisance claim.
So if you're damaged in terms of, say you're one of our sponsors, Lone Star Ag Credit, and your collateral value is basically gone because of diminishment of value because of that, which kind of happened near us, there's literally no recourse.
The only recourse you've got in that situation is to fight and try to get the best payment you can from that company that's doing the eminent domain.
Can happen when it's not even on your property.
But you're saying it's not on your property.
Yeah. And it's still like us. I've seen 40% diminishment.
There is, much like the wind tower discussion, I mean, there's zero legal avenue right now for a landowner if the project, whether it's a pipeline or transmission line or anything else, if it's on your neighbor, you have no right of action. No right of action whatever. That said, I don't want to give you false hope. There is a bill, because this is a big problem, there's a bill in the legislature this session to change that, to give a right of action to somebody like you who
to, for the loss of their property value. Now, no, it's not 421. It's another one. I don't have it. Now, I'm going to tell you, it's in the legislature. I don't want to damn it, but it is unlikely to make it very far through the legislature, right? Bills are nothing more than somebody's good idea that got stamped at the legislature. It's hard to get them through there. But the reason it got filed is that's a big problem. People are not getting compensated for genuine loss to their to the market value of their property.
And let me just say on that concept, on what your lender made me think, there's a lot of wind companies now, and not to get off into that, because we're still eminent domain here, but a lot of these things are being treated as an easement rather than a lease, like a pipeline, and they're basically you're granting it a blanket easement to use your entire property for the development. Some of the farm credit agencies hate that, and I've had people say, the farm credit agency say, look, we might not be able to take your land as collateral if that's the case. So if you have something come across and it's called an easement rather than a lease on a wind document or something, I would, and you've got an established relationship with Farm Credit, I would have that conversation with them, because you would really hate to lease something off and then your PCA or your FLCA says later, eh, we're not going to loan that because of that. So just I want to plug that while we're talking about easements and potential collateral values.
I will say, for those of you who haven't been through the eminent domain scenario, I mean, there are really two categories of damages that you can recover in eminent domain. One is the value of the part taken. So let's say there's a 150-foot wide easement in a solid strip through your property. You're entitled to the payment for that strip. The second category, which is a little harder to understand, but it's where the big numbers are, which is called damage to the remainder. Right? That's everything I own on both sides of that strip. How much market value has been lost in that project? Because there is a genuine market loss. It's extremely high with a transmission line. Pipelines are underground, and there is damage to the remainder for sure, depending on the configuration or the alignment. Because you all know you will never, ever build anything on top of a pipeline right away. That land is done. You can graze it. And if it cuts a corner, because pipeline companies, they like to just draw a straight line through somewhere. And they don't care if you're cutting off a corner or knocking out a piece of property that'll never be developed or you can't put a barn or anything else on it. But that's where the damage to the remainder is. And that's where, honestly, where much of the tension is between landowners and the eminent domain, you know, industry, is they view almost all 100% of the time, there's no damage to the remainder, right? That nice guy who loves your cows will tell you, we're going to bury it, we're going to reseed it, it's going to be prettier than your native pasture. And we'll be gone, we'll be out of here. And they won't offer you anything but the part taken, which is not much. I mean, because who would sell a 150-foot strip of property just on a pro rata acre price to somebody who's taking it? Nobody would. And so that damage to the remainder is where the big, big fight is at. Because they're very resistant to paying that because they're just sort of institutionally against the concept. Yes, sir?
Is there a possibility of getting like a 10-year renewable lease on a pipeline easement so you could get new money coming in every 10 years or so? I mean, they'd still have the right to have the pipeline, but, you know, I've got one that's on my place that's done in 1928 and three more since then.
It's extremely rare. It is possible. I know landowners that can get those, but those tend to be landowners that measure their property in sections and counties as opposed to acres. But if you are of that, you know, the university lands, that's the way they do it. I mean, it's a term. And this is an arm's length negotiation. Until they go to court and condemn you, you're negotiating, right? You're back and forth, and you can ask for it, but I'm telling you it's a steep hill because they won't want to do it, and basically all they can do is say no. But they're done. People do that. Say, I'll do a term with an increase, you know, just like a standard commercial lease that every 10 years it kicks up a certain percentage.
And please don't feel like you getting sued for condemnation is a bad thing. We just had a pipeline come through my part of the world, and some of the folks we wouldn't negotiate because they wouldn't give us any decent numbers, and they got served with the condemnation suit, and you thought these people would have, it was the worst thing in the world, oh my gosh, what am I going to do, I've been sued. I said, no, this is just part of the process. The numbers don't get real until they file the condemnation suit against you, so don't feel like getting hit with the suit, congratulations, you know, we're condemning your property. That's just when the negotiations really begin.
The other thing on that I'll say real quick. Sorry. Okay. The other thing I want to say real quick on that, and you guys in this room probably know this because TSCRA has done such a good job at educating folks, but that first offer you're going to get from the pipeline company is never going to be a good offer. Okay? It's like a used car dealer. You don't ever bite their hand off and say yes right away. All right? But the statistics show us that about 70% of people sign that first easement. Because they say things like, if you don't, we'll sue you. And people get scared and they sign it. Don't do that. Okay? You've got rights. You've got the ability to negotiate. There are things that you can do and should do to protect yourself. I think that's just an important thing to say, just so people have that background. Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay. We're in Glasscock County. That's close to the Permian Basin. I have 5 pipelines now and 2 more coming. I asked the appraiser the other day, how much has my value decreased? And she said, none. Now, like you said, now if I said, well, how did you get your appraisal value? And she said, well, it's so high because you can go build a trailer park out there instead of ag value or the valuation of the appraisal. Now then, with the pipelines going through there, you cannot build trailer park in that area. So should the appraisal value come down?
Are the appraiser you're talking about, are you talking about the county appraisal in terms of
county appraiser,
the property value of your property?
Property value.
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard one because, as you know, I mean, they're probably all good people, I assume, but they're just out there clawing for money. But the reality is, yeah, I mean, your property has been significantly diminished. You can't sort of, you're going to have to educate. Right? Because they're looking at it and just saying, well, your tract is just like anybody else's tract. But if you will draw those pipelines in there from the right-of-way for and show the distance of, if you, what would you say, 4 and 2 more coming?
Well, I'll have 7.
Okay, 7 lines. You take your property, Google map it, and color in the width of all those easements right there and say nothing will ever be constructed on top of that. Period. It's done. You can graze it. But other than grazing, you're really not going to do anything on top of that area at all. And, of course, it impacts this other property. I will tell you from experience, that's a fairly complicated conversation with an appraisal district, but it's accurate. And if you can't get it across to them, I'd get, you know, another appraiser or an attorney to talk to them about it because they've taken huge amounts of the economic value out of your property by laying those property lines in there.
I've never found a county appraisal district who found any reason why your property value should go down.
I would suggest that that does happen. It happened in Mills County, and I did sit on the appraisal review board that allowed it to happen. The unfortunate part about it is it was a big piece of land, and there were 3 large buildings on that piece of land. One was the original livestock barn, then a horse barn, and then a large home. And they were all built. One was built before the turbines came. One was built while the turbines were being built. And the last one was built after the turbines were built. And we prorated it accordingly by giving them compensation for that fact. But it does happen.
We need more people like you on appraisal review boards.
Yeah, he's highly suspicious because that's my father there. So don't.
We should have known.
Don't trust him. You should have known. Yeah, my parents doubted whether I was making a living or not, so they decided to come and check it out on their own.
Okay, we got somebody.
This is a little tangent to the eminent domain, but extraterritorial jurisdiction of municipalities where they're annexing along the side of a road or highway, how far out can they come and be claiming as extraterritorial jurisdiction? Because originally they were saying 30 feet, then they were saying 300 feet, and now I'm hearing they're talking about 2,000 yards. So I don't have anything firm, but that's just something in the back of my head that I'm concerned about.
Do you know the answer to that, Mayor?
Yeah.
Yeah, Mayor.
Speaking of things,
the Mayor of Stamford, yes.
I will, I'm fixing to Google it, and where I always have the answer to tell you in just a second. It depends on the size of the city. Like, they all have different, the rules are very common. Like everything else in Texas law, the rules are really convoluted, and there is no one-size-fits-all. So let's come back to that in just a second, because I want to answer that question. In a city, for example, the size of Stanford, it's like 500 feet it's going to be more than 30 feet, but we're not talking about a great swath. And there's a whole bunch of stuff around forced annexation in the legislature. It was a big battle around San Antonio in last year's legislature. That's applying into a lot of these subdivisions and areas that are really booming and growing and stuff that doesn't really apply to rural towns, but it does apply to these suburban areas with lots of sprawl.
Other eminent domain questions?
Sorry, I saw a hand move and was like, question, what? Anybody? Okay.
Yeah.
This is not oil or gas easement, but what if you buy a piece of property and your neighbor to the north had been using a road through there for 15, 20 years? There is nothing recorded in the courthouse saying that there is a permanent easement. He has a prescribed easement. As a new property owner, I bought this. Can I make them move that prescribed easement to get it out of the center of my property?
So Tiffany pushed the microphone over to me because somehow I've become Texas's foremost expert in the worst easement cases in the world. you're actually on the good side. I never get on the side that actually has some leverage. There are generally two types of easement, express and implied. Express, and Tiffany and I had a phone conversation about this yesterday. Express means there's a document written and recorded at the county courthouse that says you have the right to do this easement for this purpose, this width, whatever. Implied means we think there's a right there, but it's never been reduced to writing to prove it. And the only way to prove it is either to get it reduced to writing or to sue somebody. So in your case, normally I've got the guy on the other side who's trying to get across your property and has no proof anything other than he ought to have the right to get to across his property. Because there's an old wives' tale in Texas that says, I have to be given a right to access my property. That is not true. You can get to your property by helicopter. But there is nothing in Texas law that says you have to be granted a legal right of access to your property. Trust me, I've looked and I have looked and I have looked, and it doesn't exist anywhere in case law or statute. So in your case, people have an implied easement across your property, but they don't have an enforceable legal right at that point. You can tell them to move it, and they may say, no, we don't want to. We've got this right to do this. And essentially the only way they can prove that is to sue you and win up for an easement and win a court decree granting their easement across there. So that's a good way to be neighborly, to say, look, guys, I don't mind you coming across my property, and we probably need to get this coordinated, but I'd really let you move it over from this side to the other side. And if I'm the client on the other side, if I'm the lawyer for that other client, I'm going to say, that's awesome. Will you sign an express easement to us? Because then fix your problem and you fix their problem if they ever try to go sell the property.
Yeah, two things I would say there. One, just to clarify, you said they have a prescriptive easement. Are they just saying they think they could get a prescriptive easement, or they've actually got a judgment on that? Okay. You did just what James said. I mean, you did his advice without him even telling you, right? You told them, look, fine, I'll give you an express easement where I want it to be. There, if they could go to court and prove a prescriptive easement, which means an easement by adverse possession, they potentially could get a court order that says they get to use that strip. But they would have to go to court and prove that. And prescriptive easements are real tough to prove. One thing they would have to show is they never had permission to use the road. If they had permission, they will not be able to prove a prescriptive easement. So I don't know if that helps you. It's also got to be an exclusive use. No one else could ever have used that road for them to prove a prescriptive easement. So I'm not telling you they can't prove one. I'm just saying it's a hard sell to win that.
No, because the person who bought it would take their predecessor in interests rights to that easement, and that person could sue for the easement. But you can't get title insurance on a property. Well, you can. It's just subject to the lack of access. And a lender is not going to loan money on a property unless there's a recorded right of access to it. You are the dream neighbor, where who's going to say, hey, guys, you know, it's an imperfect solution. I'm going to tell my client, look, I know you'd prefer the easement from here to here, but having a written easement in a place that's not ideal is a whole lot better than not having a written easement and no actual legal rights that you can't prove without a $50,000 lawsuit. So, and if the best argument you have is a prescriptive easement, I have been there. It's a nightmare. That's the worst possible easement case. It's really difficult to prove, and unless you have lots of continuous, active, ongoing use every year, it is really tough to prove, and it's probably going to be almost impossible to prove. I'd much rather be representing you in that case than those folks.
Well, while we're on easements, I want to throw one other issue out that I'm getting a lot of calls about, particularly in the Hill Country, is more and more Texas is being sold and cut up for development, right? Texas has got all the sort of the old line easements that are written and documented that says you can come through my property to reach your property. Good neighbor stuff. There's a lot of them. But I will tell you, if you have one of those, you're there. And that tract over there, which was 1,400 acres when your grandfather gave them the easement that got recorded in the courthouse, and then it gets cut up to 100-acre tracts or smaller. That easement benefits every one of those tracts, okay? There's no, hey, that was just when it was one piece, and now it's 100 pieces. And so this is a big problem, as a lot of this land is starting to turn from generation now down to development. I'm having to tell them, hey, you've got a problem there, because you're not going to be able to put up a stop sign there at your property because those people have a legal right of access. It's not without a solution. My advice is, if you have one of those through your property and you are good friends with your neighbor, you go and renegotiate that easement now while everything is happy, and insure them, which you can. You can redraft the easement. You can replace it that says, I'll give you and the owner of that entire tract access through my property, but not otherwise, right? You can redefine those rights. But if you just leave it to the way the easement is, you could literally, I had some folks out around Fredericksburg where a big tract was going to a winery, and the folks that were buying the property are going to be running buses through their tours and having everything else right through the middle of somebody's ranch like you're talking about. And that's a big problem.
Okay, two things real quick. We're going to open it up now to any questions you have on any topic, so we'll just go crazy. The other thing, this is going to sound real simple, okay, but make sure your easements are in writing. I know that sounds dumb, but if you have an express easement where your neighbor says you can cross the road, that needs to be written down and filed in the courthouse if you ever want that to be enforceable against anybody else. And that's a step that seems dumb. My dad would be rolling his eyes at me saying that we should be able to do things on a handshake. Lawyers like me have ruined the world. Okay, I get it. You need to write it down and file it in the courthouse if you want that to be enforceable.
I'd like to ask a question. I've been getting at this time of year a lot of tax cases. I have long tax cases there in the city of Austin. You think you pay taxes, well, you come on down. But, you know, we use a valuation there. What's the value of the tract of land that they want taxes from? And then we turn around and get a power line across it. And we want to say, well, it's not as much, you know, but they say that that it's a lot less than what the tax appraiser gave you when you argued your case to the tax appraiser. Do you have any ideas that might help people on their own deal with the tax appraiser for ad valorem taxation to make sure you don't mess up a condemnation case?
Yeah, I mean, this is a banner day for me. My parents are here, and my mentor and former law partner, Ed Small, is here. So what he's talking about, if you didn't hear it, is let's say you've been in there successfully arguing your case to the appraisal district that your property is virtually worthless and being taxed at that rate, and then the condemnation company comes through, and then you got to do a 180 there. You know, this is the most valuable property ever. One is to be careful what you submit to that appraisal district. I mean, writing lasts forever. I mean, if you go to a hearing in front of the ARB, something like that, you've testified, and the chances of them seeing that or doing that are pretty small. But if you submit an appraisal, something in writing that has got your signature on it and is on your behalf, it's a value. Doesn't mean you can't get out from under it, but it could be very delicate to have to turn around and have another appraiser say, oh, no, it's worth 100 times of that. Interesting point this brings up in the sort of the legislative coming and going that we've had this session over Senate Bill 421 that you mentioned is the industry asked that they be able to value and pay landowners based on appraisal district values, right? Would you like to be paid and sell your ranch for the appraisal? Yeah, no. They had a reason asking for that, and we fought that off and told them no and no and hell no. But there's a big disparity in between those things that Ed's talking about. So if you're fighting your tax case, who knows whether you're going to be struck by the lightning of eminent domain, but you need to be very careful what you're submitting.
And just real quick, I want to answer the ETJ question to fill in on that. It's within, if you've got a town that's less than 5,000 inhabitants, it's a half mile. Then it goes up in $25,000 population increments until you get to anybody town with 100,000 or more, and it's 5 miles. And that's in Chapter 42 of the Texas Local Government Code. But there are some rules on what you can and can't do in a home rule city versus a general rule city, general law city. Some can do more than others. It's a really convoluted question, and there's all kinds of carve-outs in here for different specific cities of located near a barrier island or the Trinity River. It's a ridiculous statute.
Okay, real quick, I'm going to put our contact information up. So if you guys want to contact me for free information, I'm happy to provide that. If you want to contact one of these fools, they're probably going to charge you. But here's our info. Take it.
I'm also impacted, like this gentleman here from Gillespie County, dealing with this pipeline issue. And, of course, I've got family with land that's being impacted. And my question is, you know, if oil companies are required usually to pay royalties for drilling and pulling oil out of the ground, why are pipelines also not required to pay royalties if they are making profit by moving this across your land?
Very good question. The answer, I mean, ask your legislator, is we last session put that in the bill to not mandate royalties, but just to let it be permissible. And they came unglued, right? And it's really strange if you think about it, because this is an industry that has for more than 100 years depended upon the whole concept of let's go in here together, and I'll share with you a percentage of the success in exchange for your property, minerals, right? The whole industry is built on that concept. But yet when it comes to mere transportation, which is a small part of the oil and gas industry, they're like, well, no way. I mean, no way we'll do that. And I've asked them, you know, why not? It would save you some money up front if you would just pay a base amount for the acreage and give the landowner some sort of, you know, fraction of the value that's moving through that pipeline. And they're just, you know, they're an industry that just is very difficult to change. They don't want to change, and they just sort of like things the way it is. But that is, you know, I taught an eminent domain class over here at the law school, and they did a lot of research nationwide, and that issue you identified is one of the prevailing questions nationally, is that why should landowners who have what is a 100% privately owned piece of money-making infrastructure through their property not be able to share in the percentages of profits? But the ultimate legal answer to that question is it's not in statute, they're not required to, and they just frankly won't talk about it. Yeah, sure, exactly. I mean, the electric transmission is the same thing. I mean, they're utilities, but they're basically private corporations with shareholders, and they could certainly do it.
We got lots of hands. Okay, we'll go over here.
Yes.
Now. If you're holding the mic, you can talk.
Me. Back to the, I'm sorry.
Let him go first.
But okay. This gentleman's question back here, he's being neighborly. They've come through his property, said, I'll give you an easement, but go a different way. And James, you were saying the wives' tale that you can't be landlocked, you can be. What if he were to say, I'm putting up a gate and a lock and you can't come through here anymore, period? What's the odds of that being, I know that's not very nice, but just to just throw it out there, what's the odds of that being
then they would
successful?
They'd have to sue him to get an easement. And if I was representing them, because I had a situation like that where these people actually had really good proof, we filed for a, she said, I'm gonna build this gate and this fence and you're not going to be able to get across my property. And these people had legitimately had no other way to get there because it was in some deep sand, some shinery woods. We filed a restraining order, got the court to sign it, and then she finally cooled off and her client convinced her to agree to an injunction that would allow them to use that road. So, I mean, he's got that right if they don't have, and it's their burden to prove it, to sue him and prove it.
On that note, if y'all are interested in that topic, I did a blog post not too long ago that talked about landlocked property, and there's 4 or 5 potential ways to access landlocked property, which I think that's good to know if you're the one trying to access or if you're the guy trying to keep them out. That's on my website if that's something that would be helpful.
While we're shifting gears, how many by show of hands are on Tiffany's list of Ag Law blog? The rest of you are losing out on the most valuable free thing that exists in Texas. Google to this afternoon, Tiffany Lashman Ag Law blog, and sign up. It's like having a free lawyer inside your computer.
Sometimes we lawyers use it for legal research because she reads the cases, so we don't have to.
I'm going to put that out there. Okay, next.
So I just finished my undergrad, and I've been kind of saving up and getting ready to take the LSAT, and hopefully not more than once. Ag law is not really something that has ever been talked about a lot to me. And I just wonder, why did the four of you or any of you choose ag law? Of all of the different disciplines that there are, why did you choose that? And where do you find purpose and meaning in ag law?
So we can talk more afterwards. I'd love to give any advice, but I actually worked in the ag industry and for several years as a nutritionist, and I just love talking to landowners. And in all those conversations, you know, we weren't just talking about, you know, the price of cattle or how much, you know, these supplements were going to cost. We talked about, you know, what was going on, you know, in their family or what's going on the property. And so, you know, we had, you know, eminent domain issues that I've learned about, or, you know, you have water, oil and gas, family transition planning, so moving, you know, the farmer ranch from one generation to the next. And because of all those issues, I was like, you know what, I'm passionate about that, and I want to try to go to law school. And so I did exactly what you did. I took the LSAT, and, you know, my wife stuck with me and let me go back to school for 3 years, and here I am. So we can talk more about that later, but honestly, I have talked to all three of these individuals up here before I applied to law school or during the process, and I'm just finding people that are practicing ag law. And I'm brand new in my practice, but looking for, you know, very accomplished, talented lawyers up here, trying to find people that can provide insight and influence. I don't know if that, I'd love to talk to you more afterwards, you know, with any advice I can give, but good luck on the LSAT.
Okay. We have a piece of property that by definition is landlocked according to our county. It is landlocked because what appears to be on a handshake deal, maybe in the 1800s, it was a county road because a landman looked for days and couldn't find any documentation on it. The road was finally cut off. It became solely a driveway. The county, as the goodness of their heart, maintained a little bit of it for years, even though it wasn't on the map and this kind of thing. County commissioners change, that all stops. At some point in time, a dog leg at the end near the county road was sold. And if anybody looked at it, they'd think it was just right away. But it was sold with the property to one side of us. Thus, now the county says that property is landlocked. And because it's landlocked, they will approve no building permits, no nothing. But it's landlocked because of what they did. Not because, so it's like, how do you go about addressing that?
My most notorious easement case has a similar situation. It was pretty clear, and you look on Google Earth, it looks like what was a lane here that was very clearly, and everybody out there swore it was a county road because it was effectively operated as one. There was nothing in the commissioner's records that ever dedicated that as a county road. What you think was a county road back in the day is not always necessarily an actual county road. It's just somebody, it's something everybody operated. In this case, we were landlocked between the sheriff and the county commissioner. So you can imagine how great a situation that was, because it was coming across the county commissioner's property, and he didn't want a road on him under any circumstances. So unless you can find a dedication in the county commissioner's records that it was a county road, and there's no proof that it was ever closed by the county commissioners, unless you, barring that, you don't have a county road. It's just not. That's just how it is, because there's a ton of these things that were operated like a neighborly county road. It was just never made into one. There is a provision in the Texas Transportation Code. Is it Section 351? I can't remember exactly what it is, but that it allows you to petition the county to create a county road to a property that is landlocked. It's pretty simple. You just got to put some elements in there and take it to county commissioners. May work out great. When the people who don't want you on them is the county commissioner, that's not a great situation. But that is a tool that may be helpful to basically reinstitute it as a road there based on the historic use. Yeah.
When they owned that as part of their right of way, then we weren't, because you were bordering county property.
Yeah.
So does that make a difference?
I don't think so. I mean, the county, you could petition the county to create something across that little dog leg that they sold, but I cannot tell you how many of these problems are created because counties just kind of got sloppy over the years and didn't formally dedicate a county road, or didn't pay attention to the boundaries, or didn't really pay attention to whether things were landlocked or not. So,
we were told they can't do that.
I hear a lot of things that says that they're supposed to be like that, or they couldn't be able to do that or not. And in a perfect world, what's right and wrong? No, they shouldn't have. What actually has some law in some statutory or case law authority in Texas easement law? Probably is a whole different animal, so probably not.
And that
matters to the property value, because if your property is landlocked, give you an example. This property that I had in this county, the sheriff, the county commissioner, wouldn't let anybody come across him because, in his words, he wanted to be able to drink coffee in his underwear on his back porch without anybody driving across his property. The sheriff, on the other side, everything he's got was for sale at the right price. Land was worth about $1,500 an acre. He would sell them an easement for $3,000 an acre, but he would buy the property from them for $600 an acre. And we said, that's a third of what it's worth. He said, well, it doesn't have any access to it. So it legitimately affects the property value. So if you got a landlocked property, I'd go to the appraisal district, hire a private appraiser out there to come value a piece of landlocked property and bring it to the county and the appraisal review board, and they're not going to like the value of that property, and that you may be able to maybe use that as some leverage with the county commissioners to get something done.
Yes, I think Jim talked about water impoundments in Kimball County, and is there any restrictions or limitations as to how many impoundments upstream landowners can make that are less than 200 acre feet? Can there be more than one per landowner, or how many upstream? And if it is considered a navigable waterway, if those were unpermitted, is there any recourse?
I like your question, and I get that pretty commonly, which tells me how strategic thinkers in ag groups are. You know, it's not a one impoundment per property. There is no limit. Listen closely. There is no limit on the numbers that you can put on your property. But I hear the gears turning. That does not mean you can create a daisy chain of 200 acre foot impoundments on a stream, right? Because you're impounding way too much water. That's a, you know, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered situation. But you can have more than one. That's what the law is. But if you're putting a series of them such that you're going to be denying all downstream flow to your neighbors, you're going to have a problem there, right? Because you don't need 10 impoundments in a row there for domestic and livestock. Kimball County, the issue was not that. The issue was old, historic, oversized impoundments, way more than 200 acre feet, and many of which were built on a stream that was determined to be navigable.
That's the point I was going to make. I'm not sure we said that before. That 200-acre-foot impoundment without a permit has to be on a non-navigable stream. If it's on a navigable stream, even if it's 200 acres feet for your cow, you got to have a permit for that. And I'm not sure I made that clear earlier.
But, I mean, that's what happened out there. Now, it worked out because TCQ went out, and for those that were too big, they didn't make them tear the dams down because that would have been really hell to pay. But they made them lower some of them and siphon through there so that flow then started getting on downstream. And then it rained, you know, and then everybody got happy again.
The mineral owners and royalty owners would have a right there because they could say, look, your lease terminated on my property, my minerals, you want to use them, you want to operate it, you got to get a new lease. And that happens. Things, they don't pay product. Somebody sells an expired lease and somebody comes and tries to operate it. I'm not sure a surface owner, and Jim, correct me, I'm not sure a surface owner is going to have any sort of legal standing in that case because they don't have any right to the minerals, so they can't enforce the rights as to the minerals.
Yeah, no, it's just separate property interests, and that's it's the head-scratching part of that law is everything you just described is maybe issues between the mineral owners and the company as to whether the payments they could have got back going, but it's all their way. The surface owner, you're not in that conversation. Now, you may have some limited conversation. I mean, if it truly is abandoned equipment, it's a steep hill to climb to get it cleaned up, and lots of landowners have that problem. So you have some claims, and if there was some contamination there when the pipes were burned up and you've got salt water contamination, something like that, you may have, that's your land, you may have a claim there, but you're really not dealt into this conversation as to whether that oil and gas lease is valid. Because even if that oil and gas lease was voided, which I don't think it would be, but even if it was, doesn't benefit you if you don't have the minerals.
Could the surface owner get in touch with all of those mineral owners and have a conversation with them about, hey, you're all in gas lease here. For all practical purposes, we're null and void with XYZ oil company due to no production, and get them to put pressure on the oil.
If I'm the surface owner, hypothetically, I would contact those hypothetical mineral owners and try to see it. Tell them, look, guys, I'll front the cost of this. I'll file a suit in your name as long as you're all in, you know, as y'all are okay with it, and you'll get an agreement probably in writing to that. And then they would have to be the ones that bring the suit, but you could help push it for them so they don't have to do it because it would obviously.
They really don't owe them much obligation. I know that sounds brutal, but they don't. I mean, those are separate property interests. And the hardest law we have in Texas is a mineral interest is dominant to the surface, and there is a reasonable right to use the surface. The wildfire was bad, but it was an act of God there through there. So I don't think they have any real legal obligation to that surface owner from the mineral. And if it was, it was on the operator, the crappy operator. So I don't think the mineral owners are in any individual jeopardy. I think Decker's suggestion is the best one. Round them up, because they got shortchanged too, right? They're not happy. And so work with them, because if you kind of reestablish all the rights, which is the surface and the minerals, and y'all are all working in the same direction together, that's having the most bullets in the gun to deal with them.
And the biggest offenders were those leases from the 30s or 40s or 50s that had been assigned. It was an 8,000-acre lease, and now some shoestring operator operating right out of his garage is operating one well on 40 acres, and he can do whatever the heck he wants to do because the lease is 80 years old, and it sucks. It does. So the best thing to do there is, if you ever get a new lease, to make sure you have strict provisions as far as cleanup and removal of equipment and stuff like that. But, boy, when you get those old leases, and I fought over some of them from the 20s, I fought over some of them from the 50s, and it just... It's just not a good situation, because that reasonable use doctrine, the oil company that has got the right to use as much of the service as is reasonably necessary, and if you read the case law, what constitutes reasonably necessary is generally whatever the oil company says it is. I mean, that's just how it is.
We're going to take one more, okay?
I got about 4 dozen questions to ask you, but I'm going to... Every time...
We charge after the first one, so
okay,
knock yourself
all right.
out.
And go back to the Brazos River, senior water rights. Who's got water rights? Talk to me about water rights on the Brazos River, if you can, will.
Okay.
And I've got a specific instance back in my work.
Pretty interesting story that a lot of people learned during the hard drought, but the senior water rights holder on the entire Brazos River is Dow Chemical. Dow Chemical operates what is probably the largest chemical facility in the world on the coast, right at the mouth of the Brazos, because one needs a lot of water, and they have a lot of water. You heard Tiffany talk about our water rights are all in terms of gauge of a priority, and they have amassed that such that they hold the high card. And so when the Brazos flow went down, when you're downstream, you're at the short end of the stick. And so Dow exercised their right as senior water rights holder and put in what's called a priority call. And think about this for a minute. When they did that at TCQ, TCQ was then obligated to tell every water right holder on the Brazos, which was junior to Dow, that they had to cease withdrawals. That's all the way up the Brazos, okay? So that's the short story. I mean, everybody else is junior to Dow. The Brazos now has a water master, which is a sheriff of the river that runs all the way from the coast to the PK Dam that governs all withdrawals. If you're withdrawing water out of there under a water right, you've got to call the water master and tell them you're doing it and checking in. No, it is based on age. Everybody's got to have that water right.
Someone has a landowner from way back says, I've got the water rights, and someone wants to buy it. Right. You're going to get tied up with TCEQ for months trying to get it transferred to this buyer. And the contract contingent on those water rights getting transferred. So I'm looking at a situation. How long is this going to take? What's the likelihood of this happening? I'm beginning to question where in the scheme of things is the water rights that this seller has. So what you're saying, everybody's pretty much equal after Dow.
No. They're all on age, so it depended when they adjudicated that water right. So you're going to have 30s and 40s and 1942, 1978, 1983, and you just go in order. The oldest is the most senior.
The seller shows a letter he's got from TCEQ from, I don't know when it is, but way back, says, I've got, these have been adjudicated, these are my rights, I can transfer them, their senior to whoever. So that's got to go through the process at TCEQ and approve to that buyer. I've got he's actually getting these water rights, and he's part of the contract value, so much allocated to the land, so much allocated to the water rights. So it's a long, tedious process. Sounds like it's fairly simple and straightforward, but it takes time to somebody, bureaucracy, to work
yeah.
through the...
Well, let me simplify one thing. If you're selling a piece of property that has a water right, and you are selling the property and the water right, and the buyer is going to use the water right on that same property...
You got to have it. It won't... The deal won't... What he's trying to do won't work without the water rights. This is not just a straight old cotton or corn farm. This is some other uses, and it's worthless to me. I'm not going to buy it. I can't buy it. It's not going to work without the water rights.
Okay. Well, I just want to clarify for the audience. If you're doing that, you're selling a farm with a water right, and your buyer is going to use that water right there, that's simple. That's a one-page document, and that goes through TCEQ fast. But if you are selling a water right here to someone down there who's going to have to change that diversion point, you will have to go through the TCEQ process to change the diversion point. Well, then, if you're not changing the diversion point, it should be pretty simple. You just transfer it by contract like a deed.
Okay, so we've got to wrap up because we're out of time. Two things here real quick. We're going to put contact information back up on the screen if you need that. Listen, I'm the one who coordinates this thing. I pick lawyers to be here to introduce to you for a reason. These are three of the best in the business. Take advantage of that. They're here for a purpose, okay? The other thing I'll say is we'll stick around here for a little bit. If you guys want to visit with any of us afterwards, if you have more questions, come on up and chat with us.